You are listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Locus Focus Talk Radio with Barbara Bernstein and Arjun Makijani for a discussion on nuclear power.
Hello, this is Leah Bolger from Veterans for Peace and the campaign to keep Oregon's National Guard in Oregon. This month marks the 6th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. On March 15th, Oregonians from across the state will gather together in Salem to tell our state lawmakers to stop the wars at home and abroad, keep Oregon's guard home from Iraq and Afghanistan. The march and rally will begin at 1 p.m. on the steps of the state capitol. I urge you to join me and thousands of Oregonians in Salem on Sunday, March 15th, to tell our legislature to keep Oregon's guard in Oregon.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the next big rally and march for peace, March 15th at 1 p.m. at the steps of the Capitol in Salem, Oregon. For more information, call 503-236-3065. Buses and carpools are available.
I believe it could be something good has begun.
Black Book Talk, KBOO's monthly program on books by Black authors, moves to a new day and time this week. Hear Black Book Talk at its new day and time this Thursday at 11:30 a.m. when hosts Patricia, O.B., and Emma interview author E. Lynn Harris.
I'm very much in tune as to what it is that I do now, you know, and I'm a writer. I think one of the things you have to do as a writer is be prepared to let the characters come in and tell their story.
That's E. Lynn Harris this Thursday at 11:30 a.m. on Black Book Talk right here on KBOO.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for Wednesday morning call and talk radio here on KBOO Community Radio, where the time is about 5.5 minutes after 8 o'clock. And the number to join the conversation this morning is 503-231-8187. Well, about 30 years ago this month, the Three Mile Island accident at the large nuclear power facility in Pennsylvania, which eventually resulted in a meltdown, as we found out a few months later, basically brought to an end the nuclear power building spree in the United States. It began in the early 50s with the Atoms for Peace campaign and spawned a great number of nuclear reactors throughout the United States. And there was a belief in the 50s and through the early 60s that this was a great resource, that this was going to be electricity too cheap to meter. And with the big accident at Three Mile Island, it became quite apparent that it was way too expensive to even begin to be metering. And after that, there were no more nuclear power facilities licensed in the United States, and we thought that nuclear power as a source of electricity was pretty much a dead issue until recently. And in the last few years, it's been brought back as a great idea, as a way to deal with climate change, because after all, nuclear power plants do not emit carbon. And I've had a lot of frustrating conversations with people who I think should know better and have seem to have no memory about what all the problems of nuclear power were about. So I thought to help us deal with this today, we would be joined by Arjun Makhijani, who, among other things, he is the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research and was actually a consultant at major nuclear facility agencies such as the Tennessee Valley Authority, and he's also worked with the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory. He wrote a book a couple of years ago called Carbon Free, Nuclear Free, so I think that kind of sets his position pretty clear. And so he'll help us to understand why it is that so many people, even in the environmental movement, seem to think that nuclear power is a good idea. So welcome to Locus Focus, Arjun Makhijani.
Thank you, Barbara. I really appreciate you having me on your show.
So why is it? I mean, we thought nuclear power was dead in 1979, certainly in 1986 after the Chernobyl accident in the Soviet Union created even more havoc than Three Mile Island. What is bringing nuclear power back as supposedly a viable alternative to coal?
Well, nuclear power was never really dead. What happened was, actually goes back a little bit farther than 1979. In October 1973, we had the start of the energy crisis, which is still going on in some form. At that time, there was a cry for energy independence, and part of that was nuclear power tried to, you know, grow a great deal. People thought it would be a wonderful idea, and a lot of nuclear power plants were ordered. But the energy, the relationship of energy to the larger economy changed in 1973. People found out better ways to use energy, to use it more efficiently, and electricity, to use it more efficiently. California had efficiency standards for refrigerators. Refrigerators are four times more efficient than they were in 1972 today. And as a result, a lot of the nuclear power plants that were ordered were not needed. In fact, every single one that was ordered after October 1973 was subsequently canceled, to great expense to ratepayers, bondholders, and taxpayers. And so, but 104 power plants were completed, and they supply 20% of our electricity. A lot of the excess costs were offloaded onto ratepayers and bondholders and shareholders. And now the utilities that own these power plants, which are completely depreciated, are making money hand over fist by running them. So the nuclear power industry kind of ensconced itself, and now it's trying on that basis to come back as a savior from climate change. So it's a more complex and in a way more rich picture, literally speaking, than you presented.
Well, actually, I have memories in 1973, they were starting to build the Chochin Nuclear Power Facility. It's about 50 miles north of Portland along the Columbia River in Rainier. And, in fact, I got involved very early on in protests, first to try to stop it from being built, then to stop the building, and then finally in November 1977, a bunch of us tried to occupy the nuclear power plant as it was about to be going online. We didn't succeed. But the plant was interestingly shut down in 1992 when some X-rays were leaked that showed that it had lots of weld issues, kind of reminiscent of those welding weld X-rays that Karen Silkwood was murdered for. And so that plant, after many, many efforts on the part of the anti-nuclear community here in Oregon to shut it down, was finally shut down. And we're still, of course, holding the bag on the cost there. But interestingly, in Washington State, you mentioned all the plants that never got built, and a lot of them were on the Hanford Reservation and then scattered throughout Washington State, a program appropriately called WHOOPS, the Washington Power Public Power Consortium, and or Power Public Power System. And that was also, and those were all public utility districts, actually, that wound up holding the bag on those. So I think that if we just look around in the Northwest, we can see the picture of the failed nuclear power program. And the other part that's interesting, and you mentioned this in your book, and in 1980, I remember that the Bonneville Power Administration and over the Bonneville Regional Power Planning Council. I can't remember the name of the organization, but the Power Planning Council, something like that. And they basically started suggesting conservation as a method of dealing with the energy shortage. And in fact, up until sometime in the mid-80s, we were conserving so much energy in the Northwest. That's another reason why they didn't need all those power plants. And so I wonder if you can talk a bit more about the conservation movement that started in 1973 and how that might kind of dovetail with what we should be looking at now.
Well, let me distinguish between conservation and efficiency. What really started in 1973 was a movement for efficiency. I don't think that we've really learned to switch off the lights and to conserve by changing personal habits or living closer to work or any of those things that you would do to change your personal lifestyle. Although that seems to happen every now and then when energy prices spike and then we go back to our old ways. But the efficiency picture changed drastically. Industries became a lot more efficient. We had CAFE standards for cars. Cars used to get 12 miles per gallon in the early 70s. Even horrid as we think as the mileage is now, they get 25 miles to the gallon, which is double. Imagine where we would have been otherwise. As I said, refrigerators, air conditioners, all of these things that contribute a lot to energy growth were the subject of efficiency standards or initiatives on the part of those who are paying the cost, especially in industry. Most people don't know that industrial energy use has not grown since 1973 in the United States. It is still at the same level, even though industrial output is greater. Partly we've exported the energy-intensive industries abroad, but partly it's because, say, steelmaking has become a lot more efficient than it was. Aluminum has become a lot more efficient because energy became more expensive. So it's technology has changed a great deal, and we know how to do things much more efficiently. I mean, we still live in an abysmally inefficient economy. We think lighting became more efficient. You know, the old bulbs, incandescent bulbs, are 1% efficient on the energy. The amount of energy in the coal that winds up as visible light is just 1%. The amount of energy in the coal that winds up at visible light in these compact fluorescents is just 4%. So even our most efficient lighting that's commercially available commonly is only a 4% efficient. We can do 10, 20, 30%. So that's part of my reason for believing that we can have a completely renewable economy that's affordable is we still have at least a factor of two to improve in efficiency quite easily.
I'm talking with Ajay Makijani, who is the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research in Tacoma Park, Maryland, longtime understander of the intricacies of nuclear power and a lot of other energy issues. And if you want to join the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. It's about 14 and a half minutes after 8 o'clock this morning, and we're talking about why nuclear power has been is being promoted again as an alternative to carbon-emitting sources of energy, and why that might not be the best idea. So let's, before we get into the present, let's talk a little bit about what made nuclear power even put it on the table back in the early 50s, and let's talk a little bit about the Atoms for Peace program.
Yeah, I actually investigated, a colleague of mine and I, Scott Seleska, and I wrote a book called Nuclear Power Deception, because I was very intrigued by this claim that nuclear energy would be too cheap to meter. It was clearly a technical mistake, I thought. And then we did some research that showed that every serious study that was done in the 40s and 50s on nuclear power showed that it would be very expensive, generally more expensive than coal. This includes studies that were done by industry, by the Atomic Energy Commission, by academia. There was no dispute that nuclear power would be expensive. At the same time, you saw all this propaganda that nuclear power would be too cheap to meter. And so, well, we have a book written about it, about this propaganda, and it was called Propaganda Then. It was the fear that the Soviets would get ahead in nuclear energy and promote the Soviet atom as the peaceful atom. And this could not be allowed to happen. So Eisenhower made this Atoms for Peace speech saying how wonderful the atom was and how it was going to solve everybody's problems as a kind of a positive spin on thermonuclear weapons. And then this propaganda campaign began. And we've had this romance with nuclear energy around the world that was sparked by Eisenhower's speech that was based on a complete technical, well, you know, I think there was certainly a deception and propaganda aspect to it, and we've documented that. Nuclear energy was never going to be cheap. I mean, you're sticking radioactive rods in a pot of water to boil water. That's what a nuclear reactor is. Now, because you're doing it with dangerous materials, it's going to be a very costly boiler. There's no way that it could be too cheap to meter.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what that process is and why it's so dangerous.
Well, you know, you have something called a fissile material. There's only one fissile material that's there present in nature in abundant quantities.
And what does that mean by fissile?
Of uranium.
What does fissile mean?
I'll tell you.
Okay.
There's a variety of uranium called uranium-235. And uranium-235 can sustain a chain reaction. And roughly speaking, that's a fissile material, something that can sustain a chain reaction. So if you split one atom of uranium, you generate the particles called neutrons that will split another atom, and so it'll keep the reaction going. Every time you split an atom, a lot of energy is released, a really huge amount of energy is released. And so with a small amount of material, you can boil a lot of water. That has been the attraction of nuclear energy, that with a tiny fuel pellet, you can boil lots and lots of water. And, of course, if you can boil water, you can run a steam turbine, and that generates electricity just like in a gas or coal-fired power plant or in a solar thermal power plant. The downside of it, of course, is this uranium-235 is the same material that can be used to make a bomb. Now, in a nuclear reactor, you're using a fuel that has about 3-4% fissile material. In a bomb, you typically would need more than 50%, typically 90% fissile material, uranium-235 or plutonium. But the same equipment that gave you 4% enriched fissile material can give you 90%. That's the problem we're having with Iran. This centrifuge facility they're building at Natanz is ostensibly for commercial nuclear power plants, but the same facility can be used to make bomb-grade material. Exactly the same process, same facility, same industry, same centrifuges. You just run them longer, and you reroute the material, and it becomes more and more enriched in fissile component, and then you can make a bomb with it. So this is one of the problems, and it's been recognized since the beginning of the nuclear age that nuclear power would constitute a proliferation headache. The other thing is, when you operate the reactor, you have another kind of uranium called uranium-238, which is not fissile. That is not a fuel. It doesn't sustain a chain reaction. But uranium-238, by transmutation, which is a kind of a chemical magic, you know, that all the old alchemists wanted to do in the Middle Ages, well, you can turn uranium into plutonium. And plutonium is a fuel, and again, it can be used to make bombs or it can be used to run reactors. So you've got this dual side to nuclear power that you cannot get away from. Partly also it's very expensive because every time you split an atom of a fissile material like uranium or plutonium, you create fission products, two fragments that are extremely radioactive. So at the end of the process, you wind up with huge amounts of radioactivity that you didn't have before because you're splitting these atoms. So now you have radioactive waste that contains plutonium, which is bomb material that can be separated from this waste, and the French do it, for example. And we can talk about what the French are doing. I've studied that. And you've got radioactive waste that have half-lives of tens of years, hundreds of years, thousands of years, and millions of years. So you got to get rid of this stuff, and nobody's figured out a way to do it well. And so you've got all of these costly environmental and proliferation problems associated just with boiling water. And it becomes very expensive, and that's why I don't think it's a good way to... My understanding of this problem is not ideological. It's financial and technical. And can we afford this energy source that's generating bomb materials and that requires bomb materials when we have better ways to do things?
I'm speaking with Archer Makijani, who is a physicist and the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. And we're talking this morning about the problems with nuclear power as a solution for dealing with climate change. And you can join the conversation by calling 503-231-8187. It's about 21 and a half minutes after 8 o'clock. We have Diet on the line. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Barbara. Fascinating. I'm learning a lot from your guest in the discussion that, or the explanation that he just gave about how the whole nuclear fission works. But I want to go back to something that I think I heard him say earlier, that gas fuel efficiency on vehicles was like 12 miles per gallon or something in the early 70s. But I remember TV ads, I don't know when I'm remembering them from, was it the 60s, that they were advertising cars that got 35, 40 miles per gallon.
Actually, that was 1973, 74. It was the Chevette. Got 38 miles to the gallon. It was the first American car to break,
Barbara.
to break the barrier of the 15 miles to the gallon barrier.
Ah, yeah. But that was then in reaction to this. That was the improvements that your guest
right.
Had.
Now, Volkswagen Bugs got really close to 30 miles to the gallon in the, probably going back to the 40s. I mean, they were always really efficient cars.
Right, right.
Well, you know, my boss, David Freeman, I was in Washington, D.C. during the first energy crisis and worked for the father of energy policy in this country. I was kind of his right-hand man on efficiency numbers. He lives in Los Angeles now, actually. He, I think, bought an early Honda Civic, and I think that was a car that was introduced around that time, and it gave, I think, 40, 45 miles to the gallon.
Hmm. Much better. We have a Honda Civic Hybrid now, and we're lucky to get 40 miles to the gallon in that car.
That's true. That's much more expensive, too. I am.
Right.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
No, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling.
Okay.
Well, I'm talking with Ajay Makijani, and we're talking about the problems of nuclear power as a panacea for climate change. You can join the conversation by calling 503-231-8187. We've got Jeremy on the line. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah. I have a comment and a question, and the question's more important, so I hope you'll respond to that if you only choose to respond to one of them. The comment is that I think that the proliferation issue, which was well understood, wasn't a problem for them. That the idea that it would be too cheap to meter was an attempt to make the entire technology sort of acceptable to everybody. And they wanted the ability to have weapons-grade material being produced everywhere. So the same thing that would allow us to blow up the world would also keep our refrigerators running. And that didn't bother them, because at the same time this was all going on, I helped start the Oyster Shell Alliance in New Orleans, and Edward Teller was coming to town, so I got a file of his newspaper clips from the 50s, and it showed that he wanted to send commandos into Eastern Europe with little A-bombs on their back. So I really think that the sort of driving impulse of military radioactivity and commercial radioactivity sort of were in concert, and this was all intentional.
And what's your question?
That's my comment.
Okay.
My question is, when I run into what seems to me to be demented nuclear advocates these days, they always talk about the fact, well, look, you know, Europe is doing this. The rest of the civilized world, you know, they have single payer health care, that they have reasonable housing for everybody, and in general they're more advanced than we are. But they also understand the nuclear power, the safety issues have been solved, and it's really not a big deal. And I just think they're crazy. But given that I'm not a scientist, I just respond politically.
Well, that's a good question, because I was going to ask Arjun that same question. So what do you say to these people, especially when they, because I was at a conference of environmental journalists last fall, and there were several people in discussion about nuclear power who were saying, well, the French have figured it all out. So have the French figured it all out?
Well, the French have done some things well. You have to credit the French with doing nuclear power about as well as it can be done. So if you take a look at their system and it still doesn't look too good, then you have to pause. The trouble in this country with the French debate is almost nobody really has a serious command of all the relevant facts. So if I could hold forth for 3 or 4 minutes.
That's what you're here for.
All right. So the French had a problem in 73 in in that not only was their transportation and industrial sector largely running on oil, a large part of the electricity sector was running on oil. So they made a kind of a command decision to go nuclear. It wasn't very democratic. There wasn't a huge consultation. They did it. And within 25 years, about 75-80% of their electricity was coming from nuclear. So they solved the oil problem in the electricity sector quite well. But they created a lot of other problems. For instance, they import all of their uranium. Right now, they've got the Tuareg in Niger fighting the multinational companies and the French government-owned company, Areva, and the Chinese and everybody else, because they've been exploited, just like the people in Nigeria are fighting the oil companies because they don't get any benefits for all the pollution and resource extraction that happens on their land. That's one problem. The other problem is that the French haven't figured out what to do with their spent fuel, nuclear waste. So everybody says the French are recycling. This is maybe 1% true. So as I was explaining, the spent fuel contains a lot of unused uranium and 1% plutonium and these very highly radioactive fission products that are a waste. So the French put this in a giant chemical factory in the Normandy Peninsula at a place called La Hague, and they extract the plutonium and use most of that as a fuel to generate less than 10% of their electricity. Now, this is very expensive to do, so they spend 2 cents a kilowatt hour, about a fourth or a third more per kilowatt hour to do this. In the process, they have a very dirty factory. They discharge 100 million gallons of liquid radioactive waste into the English Channel every year, and they've polluted the oceans all the way to the Arctic and upset Western European governments to the point that 12 out of 15 of them have asked the French and the British, who do the same, to stop, and the British and the French haven't done it. They've got 10,000 bombs worth of surplus separated plutonium that can be used to make bombs sitting in the Normandy Peninsula. They've got all of this high-level radioactive waste, but no repository to put it in. And it turns out the French are just as allergic to having a repository in their backyard as anybody else. They don't like it. They're resisting it. We've studied their repository program, and it has many strong research features. But, you know, that said, they still can't assure you, look you in the face, and say, this is going to be safe and meet radiation protection norms for future generations. And that is a central problem with this stuff. So iodine-129, it's got a half-life of 16 million years. So how are you going to protect the water supply for 16 million years from this stuff? And the French, you know, haven't been able to figure it out confidently, and that's why I think we ought to be on a track to stop making more nuclear waste. So if we did not have any other way of generating electricity in a sensible fashion economically compared to nuclear power, I think, you know, with the climate problem the way it is, there might be a case for nuclear power. There are a lot of sensible people who think we ought to go nuclear power. So I don't condemn people who are advocating nuclear power now as crazies. I think there are vested interests, but certainly there is a sensible public debate to be had, and you are encouraging the public to have it. And part of my job is to, you know, put clear facts on the table, even if they're not ideologically comfortable. There is a sensible debate to be had, but let me give you some numbers. New nuclear power plants would cost somewhere between 10 and 20 cents a kilowatt hour to generate electricity, and if you have delays and so on, it could cost more. Wind power today costs somewhere between 8 and 12 cents without generating any waste and without generating any headaches, and wind power is so much more attractive than nuclear that you can actually raise money on Wall Street to make wind power plants, but nuclear power plants cannot raise money on Wall Street. So nuclear power plant builders want 100% loan guarantees from the federal government, and I see absolutely no reason to give them those guarantees. Solar thermal power, where you focus the sun's rays and boil water, You know, we've got a free thermonuclear reactor 93 million miles away. It's called the sun. And all you need to do is focus the sun's energy on some liquid, then you boil it. It's a much better way to boil water, and then you can run steam turbines. Now, it turns out we can do this about as cheaply as the cheapest new nuclear power plant we can build. Southern California Edison just ordered about 1.3 gigawatts of solar thermal power. That'll generate about half as much or a third as much energy as a very large nuclear power plant. And it's going to be cheaper than nuclear power overall, or certainly competitive with it. And it's becoming cheaper. So, you know, I think those who advocate nuclear power have not taken a very good look at the great changes in technology that have happened in the last 3 or 4 years. I don't think it's an illegitimate debate, but I think it's not a very well-informed debate.
Well, one of the things that keeps bothering me when I have these discussions with people are the unresolved problems from the 70s and 80s about nuclear power. And I have memories. I spent a fair amount of time on the Hanford Reservation getting tours. Though, interestingly, the last tour I went was on the Hanford Reservation. It had to do with fish and salmon restoration.
Right.
And because now they're touting it as a wildlife refuge because it's the last undammed part of the Columbia River.
Right.
But I remember in the early 80s getting a tour of this huge shaft in a place called Gable Mountain where they were doing a test they were trying to get Hanford to be one of the long-term nuclear repositories.
Right.
And it was on the list with Yucca Mountain and a couple other places. I think there were still some salt mines in New Mexico that were on the list. And the people in the Tri-Cities area of Washington were really pushing to have Hanford be the permanent nuclear repository. And those of us downstream were going, no, 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 we don't want it. And there were all kinds of problems that were coming out and that are still coming out about Hanford as being, I mean, it is right now the permanent repository for all kinds of waste that is leaking and getting closer and closer to the Columbia River. In your book, you talk about why Yucca Mountain is such a bad idea and that you thought it was the worst of all the places. But I wonder if you could also address Hanford and why Hanford was such a bad place and why it didn't get chosen back in the early 80s to be the nuclear, permanent nuclear repository.
Well, it was actually chosen as one of the top three by the Department of Energy. There was the Hanford, there was Yucca Mountain, and a salt site in Texas in Deaf Smith County, if I remember right, were chosen as the top three to be investigated under the Nuclear Waste Policy Act. I always thought, you know, that Hanford and Yucca Mountain were chosen because they were on federally controlled land and that the technical reasons were rather weak. And I say this as somebody who thinks that, you know, we need a repository for existing spent fuel. And I don't know, repository is the least bad solution. I don't think we can leave all this plutonium lying around indefinitely at 60-odd sites. But that said, you know, if you look at Hanford, and you look at the geological research on Hanford, first of all, it's very dangerous for workers because it's, as you go down in the rock at Hanford, it gets hotter and hotter, and it is insufferably hot, too hot for human beings to work down there. And one of the most eminent geologists in this country, Dr. White, had written back then that it would require a mining and air conditioning operation underground that is greater than anything that has ever been seen, and that the cost in energy and lives of materials, including workers' lives, could very well be great. And so, you know, perhaps there were better sites than Hanford. The other problem with Hanford is the rock pressures are, it's quite strange. The horizontal rock pressures are greater than the vertical ones, so it tended for the rock to burst as you were mining. And you know, there are actually photographs of the rock disking and creating, that is, bursting in the form of small disks. Additional worker problems. So before any waste was put in Hanford, there was a whole question as to whether you could create a mine that was big enough to put waste in there that wouldn't kill the workers who were doing it, or a good many of them. And then Hanford has so much groundwater that is so fast flowing compared to, now we're talking about groundwater that doesn't flow fast, but relatively speaking compared to other places, that it could erode away like these glass wastes that are being made at Savannah Riverside that need to be buried somewhere. So Hanford was all in all, I think, maybe the second worst site after Yucca Mountain. Yucca Mountain is even worse than Hanford, I think.
So the other thing, though, and I would agree with you that we need to find some place to permanently place all this waste that's sitting, like, right now in cooling ponds in
yes.
places like the Trojan Nuclear Power Plant north
yes.
of Portland. But the other issue that was raised at the time was about the dangers of transporting waste, and how can that be resolved?
Well, it can't be. You know, I mean, transporting waste is going to remain a risk, especially now with, you know, the problems of terrorism and so on. I think you can certainly harden the canisters so that, you know, with very severe accident, you don't have major waste leakages. And I think you have to grant the people who've designed the transport canisters, to a large extent, they've tried to address these problems. There've been accidents with high-level waste on board that have not resulted in catastrophe. Eventually, we're going to have to transport this stuff to a repository, but I think unnecessary transport should definitely be avoided. The thing that I've advocated in the interim is what I call hardened on-site storage. So for a place like Trojan, where the power plant is shut down, the spent fuel does not need to be stored in the pools. It can be taken out of the pools and put in storage that would be hardened like missile silos against terrorist attacks, so that it can be safely stored there, you know, as safely as possible for a few decades until we figure out, you know, where to build this repository.
Well, I'm talking with Ajahn Makhijani, who's an expert on issues nuclear and other kinds of energy, and we're talking today about the problems with nuclear power as being touted as a solution for climate change. You can join the conversation by calling 503-231-8187. It's about 21 minutes before 9 o'clock here on Locus Focus. Mike is on the line. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning. You're on the air.
All right, thanks. Yeah, just could you please speak about kind of a combination of the last two points? One, encouragement of countries like in Europe that have been doing this a long time and maybe in a way perfected it vision-wise. And also the extent, even when they're, like some of the Scandinavian countries, just stopping and doing away with their immediate program, still having to go to such lengths to find repositories. Like, for instance, aren't there a couple of really, really high-tech holes in the mountains, holes in the ground in Scandinavia, where you could fit a couple of Empire State Buildings? And they're basically just dumping stuff in there. I mean, could you speak to that, the reality of Scandinavia, like, quitting the nuclear program or scaling back, but still having to deal with all that extra cost? Thanks.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Well, I think you're probably referring to Sweden. Hello?
Hey, hang on a second. Okay, sorry about that.
Yeah. You're probably referring to Sweden. Sweden has long had, you know, what has been regarded in the scientific community as one of the best repository programs. They've gone about it in a very, very systematic way. And they actually had made a decision to get out of nuclear a couple of decades ago, that they were going to not build any more plants and phase out the existing plants. But they've actually reversed that decision in recent weeks, actually, in order to take another look because of carbon dioxide constraints. That's what I was saying, is this is a more serious debate than some in the anti-nuclear community are willing to recognize, and we have to deal with it that way. The Swedes do not have an operating repository for high-level waste as yet. They've been doing a lot of research. They've designed some canisters that they claim will last for a very long time. What they do have is a repository for what are called intermediate-level waste. This is your plutonium-contaminated waste and your highly radioactive waste that comes when you irradiate steel and other things, so you get long-lived radioactive material just as a byproduct of having high number of neutrons, which make non-radioactive things radioactive simply by being absorbed into normal elements. So they have a repository, and there are resins and filters that become radioactive in the course of operating nuclear power plants. They have a deep geologic repository for that. But there is no operating deep geologic repository for high-level wastes or spent fuel. Even the Swedes don't have it.
So I'm talking with Ajahn Makajani, who is an expert on nuclear issues and other energy issues, and he's the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. And we're talking this morning about why nuclear power is being explored as an option, an alternative to carbon-emitting energy producers like coal and oil, and some of the problems with that. And you can join the conversation by calling 503-231-8187. I want to let you know that coming up on KBOO this morning at 9 o'clock, it's Alternative Radio. The speaker is journalist Nina Baker, author of The Body Toxic, How the Hazardous Chemistry of Everyday Things Threatens Our Health and Well-Being. Baker is a former staff writer for The Oregonian. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, news and commentary hosted by Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, Marjorie Cohn of the National Lawyers Guild discusses recent documents that implicate many officials in the Bush administration in crimes of torture. At 11, it's the bike show at a new time. Today, celebrate amazing cyclists, learn more about local bike heroes and the upcoming Alice B. Toeclips Awards ceremony that will honor their good work. Call in with your bike heroes at 503-231-8187. This is a reminder, you might notice our schedule is a little bit different than it was last week. We're trying some new things here with public affairs in the morning and hopefully make it more pleasurable for your listening. So that's what's coming up this morning. Right now we're talking with Ajahn Makajani, and we're talking about some of the problems and challenges of thinking about nuclear power as being even a stopgap interim source of energy until we work our way into a totally green future. You can join the conversation by calling 503-231-8187. It's about 17 minutes before 9 o'clock here on Locus Focus. Scott is on the line. Good morning. You're on the air.
Thanks for the program, Barbara.
You're very welcome.
A question for your guest. Pebble Bed Reactors, the current chairman of the board of Portland General Electric, who was picked by Enron, still there, and he was the head of the Nuclear Policy Institute about 2001, and there's a speech on Google where he was forecasting the future, saying that nuclear power would help with global warming crisis. Question is, he touted the pebble bed reactors, which are basically graphite tennis balls with the radioactive material in it, and they're saying that, you know, if it doesn't have any water, coolant would leak away, that it would be completely stable, therefore no meltdown, and also that they're modular, that they can be maybe the size of a living room, and you can bury them underground so they could be near neighborhoods, so they could be really close to the urban supply or urban users. What's your comments?
Thanks for calling.
All right. There's no new reactor idea. There was a pebble bed reactor that was built in Germany as a prototype. It operated moderately well. There are golf ball size fuels that contain very small grains of sand with fissile material, uranium in it. Now, you don't avoid the problem of proliferation because you still need enrichment for these things. Secondly, if you look at the history of nuclear power accidents, you will find that the most serious accidents have actually occurred in the graphite-moderated reactors. Chernobyl was a graphite-moderated reactor. Windscale, which was a reactor in England, had a major fire there in 1957. It was, you know, the first really very, very serious nuclear reactor accident. And they actually collected milk from the area, dumped 500,000 gallons of milk, and so on. It's true that a graphite-moderated reactor with that kind of fuel will not have a meltdown, and it is cooled by helium gas, so it's an inert material. But if you have a loss of coolant, then you've lost your helium, and the helium will, of course, rise, being a very light gas. And when you have air in contact with very hot graphite, then you have the risk of fire. So that's a pretty serious problem. You know, it's very ironic that the reactors that we have today were touted as inherently safe in the 50s because graphite-moderated reactors cooled by inert gases were regarded as higher risk due to the risk of fires. And so there's no reactor that is going to be immune from catastrophic releases of radioactivity that has been thought of or designed or demonstrated. These reactors are modular, but they've been proposed to be built without secondary containment. Not a very good idea. If you build modular reactors with secondary containment, then they become very expensive because the secondary containment on a small reactor, then you've got to put one containment on a very small amount of power. So between the problems of economics, the problem of safety, the problem of proliferation, it's very hard to get out. My question for the proponents of nuclear energy is, why do you want the headaches when we know how to generate electricity and create a reliable electricity system without any of these problems, and we know how to do it more cheaply? You can download my book at IEER.org. We have a Carbon-Free Nuclear-Free Alliance. You can download it from CarbonFreeNuclearFree.org.
We have a link to that on our website as well, to the Locus Focus page of KBOO, so people can go to the page for the show this morning, KBOO.fm/Locus Focus, and there'll be a link to our Jones book, which I actually downloaded the other day, and I bound it, and I've been reading it, and it's a really good book. And
thank you. I'd be happy to send you a complimentary copy if you like, Barbara.
Oh, I'd love that. Yeah. Actually, I screwed up the back of it, and laid it backwards. So,
send me your address. I'll sign one for you.
I will do that. Thanks a lot. And I would recommend it because I think it's pretty straightforward reading, and I am somebody who reads a fair amount of science, but I skip all the formulas, and I don't think there's any mathematical formulas in the book.
No,
so
it's a policy-oriented technical book.
Now, one more thing about nuclear repositories is when you wrote this book, which was in the dreary year of 2007, when we still were dealing with a lot of the Bush administration policies, you were talking about Yucca Mountain being such a terrible choice as a repository, but things are moving along. Well, just a few days ago, Yucca Mountain was taken out of any funding for, and I forget which bill, that's some appropriation bill that's going through, that Yucca Mountain seems to be a dead issue. It's not going to be the nuclear repository. So if that's not going to be the one, where is it going to be? And are we going to have to start from scratch finding the safe place to store all of our nuclear waste?
Well, I've always been against rushing to find, quote-unquote, a safe place. This is because the definition of a safe place is kind of misunderstood, partly because of the way the nuclear industry and the labs and scientists approached this problem initially. Initially, they thought we need to find a geologic formation where the waste will remain stable and not leak out. And that's why they all gravitated to salt, because they thought, well, the reasoning is the salt is there because water is not there. If water had been there, the salt would have dissolved away. So we put it in salt, hot. The heat from the waste will make the salt melt around, and won't melt around the waste, and it won't go anywhere. It was very simplistic reasoning. It turns out that you can't put spent fuel on salt very easily because the mine is not stable enough to take that hot waste. Secondly, so you can't magically put spent fuel in a deep mine repository. You've got to be able to make the mine first and put this hot waste. Now you've got a very, very big hole in the ground, so you don't have a geologic setting that was like the original one. You've got a hole that's in communication with the environment. Rain can get in there. Water can get in there. So you've got to backfill it and seal it. Now, will these sealant materials hold up? Will the joints actually not start leaking water? So it turns out that the problems of creating a repository involve the geology. They involve what kind of containers are you going to have, and will they corrode? And then how are you going to backfill this mine so that the joints and seals don't give way over very long periods of time? Now, my recommendation has been that we take a deep breath and research these three issues in the lab, in theoretical science, in existing dumps where we already got lots of radioactive waste, and we have these low-level waste dumps, we have intermediate-level waste. We've got a lot of places where we can do research without dumping more radioactive waste. And then after 10 years, come up with a plan for how we're going to solve these three issues simultaneously and what a site selection process would look like. I think if we did it that way, it'd be more scientific. The public might not like it, but they'd be more prone to accept it, especially if we say we're not going to generate more waste after this set of nuclear power plants. We're going to be done with it. And we'd have at least something of a shot of looking our kids in the eyes and say, we didn't do too well by generating this stuff, but, you know, not too bad in terms of how we're getting rid of it.
Well, I'm talking with Arjun Makhijani, who's the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, and we're talking about the problems with nuclear power as a panacea for climate change. We've got a few more minutes left. We have a couple callers on the line. We're going to take Jared first. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for the show.
Sure.
I was actually wondering if your guest could speak to the... Actually, I heard a story on the local news a while back about them attempting to glassify the nuclear waste, and that they built a scale factory in Washington to attempt to take the first steps of doing this. And I was wondering if he was familiar with this or if he could speak any more to this.
Okay, thanks a whole lot
Thank
for
you.
Calling.
All right, bye.
Yeah, I'm quite familiar with it. The French actually take their high-level waste from their reprocessing plant, the plutonium extraction plant that I talked about earlier, and that's what they do with it. You know, you get a hot, very highly radioactive, acidic waste. It's a liquid waste, and they pour it into molten glass, and then they get this large radioactive glass log. And they actually have, you know, large numbers of these glass logs stored in the Normandy Peninsula awaiting a deep geologic repository. But in order to get this, you'll first have to split apart the spent fuel into its components, plutonium, uranium, and fission products. And that's the reprocessing piece. That's what was done at Hanford for military purposes. But at Hanford, they made quite a mess of the waste management. I think in that regard, the French have done a better job, or for that matter, the Idaho National Lab did a better job. The wastes at Hanford are of a consistency that is going to be very difficult to treat and classify. And that's why we don't have a successful vitrification or classification program at Hanford, not because we don't know how to make glass. We do. But it's been very difficult to figure out how to get the waste out of those tanks, many of which have leaked.
Yeah. Actually, the first time I went to Hanford, they gave me a little black marble with my press kit, and it was an example. Like they told me, no, there's no radiation in that glass marble, but it was supposed to be an example of the vitrified logs that they were going to make. And that was 1982.
Yeah, we know how to make glass. This is not an issue. The issue that I've always felt is very serious at Hanford is the Department of Energy has never properly technically addressed what is called the pretreatment of the waste. Getting the waste out of the tanks safely and characterizing it and treating it so that it is suitable to be mixed with molten glass. You can't mix anything in molten glass because it won't stick in it. For instance, you cannot mix metal in molten glass because it'll separate. You need oxide. So crystal, for instance, is lead oxide mixed with molten glass, and it stays in there. But they really have spent an enormous amount of money at Hanford, largely, in my opinion, on the wrong track. They've been able to stabilize some tanks and reduce some of the risks in the last 15 years. But overall, for long-term management, I think they have not done a very good job.
Well, the last time I was there, which I think was almost 7 years ago, and the guy who was representative for Fluor, who's now the main contractor, he was boasting that they are no longer dumping raw radioactive waste into unlined pits. So that's the big step that they've made forward.
Well, you have to grant him that.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that he stressed it, he said it about four times in the interview, and I was like going, well, at least you're admitting that you used to do it. Well, we're almost out of time. I'm talking with Arjun Makhijani, who is the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, on a subject that I think we need to be talking a lot more about. In fact, we will be. We're going to have Carl Grossman on April 4th, and we'll be talking some more about some of the problems with nuclear power. But I've got one last question for you, Arjun. When I go to my next Society of Environmental Journalists conference, and I'm sitting around in a room of people who are saying that nuclear power is the answer, in two sentences, what can I say to them to maybe put them on a different track?
Yeah. We have a limited amount of money to solve the climate problem. Nuclear power is very expensive. The second problem is nuclear power involves a waste and proliferation issue that cannot really be separated out and safely managed. The only way to deal with it is to phase it out. So if we did not know how to handle the energy problem, otherwise there'd be a strong case for nuclear power. But because we know how to do it better, faster, and cheaper, I think there's no case for nuclear power, even in the interim, because it takes so long to build nuclear power plants, and they're so expensive that we can reduce carbon dioxide much faster and cheaper by being efficient and going to wind and solar energy.
Well, I've been speaking with Arjun Makhijani, the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. It's been really fun talking with you, and I'm sure we'd like to have you on again soon and talk some more about this and all the other energy issues we can talk about.
Thank you, Barbara.
Thanks a whole lot for joining us. And you've been listening to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Burston. I want to thank you for listening. Next week, I actually do not have a subject planned yet. I'm thinking we may be talking about that peace march that's going to be happening in Salem on the 15th. I need to work on and arranging that. And then the following week, Bob Salinger is going to be here. We're going to be talking about creating a wake-free zone in the Holgate Channel between the east bank of the Willamette River and Ross Island, and also talking about some of the issues of trying to protect parts of Hayden Island from development and restore it as a or protect it as a wildlife habitat. So that's all coming up in the next few weeks on Locus Focus. We're going to go out with some music by Abby Lincoln, and stay tuned for Radio Zine and all the other great programming throughout the day here on KABU.
Cascadia. My name is Steve, and this is the KBOO Community Calendar for Wednesday, March 4th, 2009. Women of Color, come join the Sister Circle every other Wednesday at 6 p.m. at the PSU Women's Resource Center. This is a Women of Color success group presented by the PSU chapter of the NAACP, the Black Cultural Affairs Board, and the PSU Women's Resource Center itself. This series ends on March 18th, so come and get it while you can, girlfriends. Join us for an inspiring evening with Randy Shaw, author of the new book, Beyond the Fields, Cesar Chavez, the UFW, and the Struggle for Justice in the 21st Century. In Beyond the Fields, Shaw reveals the untold story of how the spirit of Si, Se Puede, that began with Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers in the 1960s, still sets the course for today's social justice movements. Randy Shaw's presentation is at the Multnomah Central Library, Collins Gallery, from 6 to 7:30 p.m. tonight. Rethink is an annual education program sponsored by the Portland Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, dedicated to exploring what it takes to successfully remodel and create healthy homes and sustainable home sites. Classes are geared to homeowners and small contractors. Guest speakers give presentations on a variety of current topics. There are 5 classes in the series, with the first class tonight on ultra-low energy homes. Tonight's class is at the EcoTrust Building, second floor. That's 721 Northwest 9th Avenue in Portland. Call 503-823-5431 for more information.
The Mount Tabor Presbyterian Church continues their weekly Divorce Care for Kids programs to help children heal from the pain of divorce and separation. Everyone is welcome every Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. The Mount Tabor Presbyterian Church is located at 5441 Southeast Belmont Street. Information and links are at the church website, www.mounttaborchurch.net. The Portland Central American Solidarity Committee is meeting tonight at 7 p.m. at Liberty Hall. PCASC is a grassroots organizing international solidarity and immigrants' rights organization. The general meeting is for anyone interested in Latin American solidarity work, local immigrant rights work, or fighting free trade agreements. Liberty Hall is located at 311 North Ivy, south and west of Fremont and Vancouver Williams. This has been the KBOO Community Calendar for Wednesday, March 4th, 2009. Thanks for listening. If you support full-strength, volunteer-powered, homegrown community radio, then browse on over to www.kboo.fm and click Join Now.
And it is 2 minutes past 9 a.m. on KBOO in Portland. And coming up this morning on KBOO, we have our new schedule of programs between now and noon. So coming up next will be Alternative Radio, followed by Air Cascadia with news and commentary by Chris Andre and Liam Delta at 10:15, Flashpoints. And then at 11, you'll hear the bike show today. So do stay tuned to KBOO. And coming up, just bear with me. Here we go, Alternative Radio.
The bottom line with respect to these flame retardants is that they may be the PCBs of the 21st century, and like the other chemicals I've talked about today, we're exposed to them daily. So there are now proposals before the state of California and the U.S. Congress that would greatly improve the status quo with respect to how we use and manage toxic chemicals in our everyday things. These overhauls would safeguard our children and our grandchildren from the error of our ways.
That's Nana Baker, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Nana Baker on The Body Toxic. More than four decades ago, Rachel Carson in Silent Spring first warned that man-made chemicals were taking a deadly toll on birds and wildlife. Now the problem has spread to humans. We are recognizing that chemicals are affecting sexual development and reproduction and can cause central nervous system diseases, cancer, and liver disease. Everyone now carries a dizzying array of chemical contaminants, the byproducts of industry that contribute to a host of health problems in ways just now being understood. These toxic substances, unknown to previous generations, accumulate in our fat, bones, blood, and organs as a consequence of womb-to-tomb exposure. Almost everything we encounter, from soap to soup cans and computers to clothing, contributes to a chemical load unique to each of us. Scientists refer to it as chemical body burden. Chemical companies would rather consumers never knew about the potential dangers their products pose. To talk about these issues is Nana Baker. She's a former staff writer for the Arizona Republic, the Oregonian, and United Press International. Her award-winning investigation of Nike's Indonesian factories led to numerous improvements for workers. She's the author of The Body Toxic. Nana Baker spoke in Seattle, Washington.
How did I get started on this path writing about toxic chemicals and everyday things? Well, a few years ago, when I was still working on the staff of the Arizona Republic, I was reading the New York Times, and I stumbled onto this article about some new work by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And it said the CDC was tracking traces of chemical pollutants in people, and including some chemicals used in everyday products. So they were finding these substances in the blood and urine of a representative sample of the population. And these kinds of measurements are called biomonitoring. So up until I heard about biomonitoring, I had thought of pollution as an external insult to the environment. And but what the CDC was reporting and tracking, it really brought home for me the concept that our bodies really share the burden of pollution. So at the same time that I had this shift in my thinking about pollution, I considered that the information gathered through biomonitoring really raised some important questions that I thought I might be able to answer as a journalist. Should we be concerned about the effects of these pollutants on our health? Can everyday items be responsible for the chemicals inside us? And don't regulators already make sure we're safe from daily doses of hazardous substances? So I started digging around, and I discovered some things that were really stunning. And so I'm just going to read a few paragraphs of how I begin to tell the story of what I found. The turnoff to the tiny hamlet of Bolinas is unmarked from California Highway 1 as it twists along Pacific Ocean headlands 1 hour north of San Francisco. Every time highway crews put up a sign pointing to Bolinas, the locals take it down. A building moratorium enacted in 1971 preserves Bolinas much as it was during its counterculture heyday, a colony of 1,560 artists, writers, healers, and activists intent on safeguarding their bohemian community from commercial encroachment. While many mansions and new subdivisions dot nearby Stinson Beach, Bolinas still looks like it did when Richard Nixon was in the White House and Bill Clinton inhaled. Downtown boasts a grocery store with more free-range dogs loitering outside than patrons shopping inside, a restaurant that serves the freshest ingredients from nearby farms, and a gas station with a bed and breakfast above it. Victorian houses and weathered clapboard cottages rim the shore of Bolinas Lagoon, a haven for pelicans and a regular pit stop for migratory birds navigating the Pacific Flyway. Living costs have gone up in Bolinas, but local sensibilities and the pristine landscape have stayed the same. 20 years ago, Charles Patton discovered the town and fell in love with it. "I used to come out to Bolinas and play music," said Patton, a pianist and singer who studied at the Berklee College of Music in Boston. That led to playing bluegrass and jazz for a living. She met her husband, Michael Lerner, in Bolinas. He founded and directs Commonweal, an alternative medicine think tank and cancer healing center that occupies a former RCA transmission site overlooking the Pacific in Bolinas. That always strikes me when I think about a former RCA transmission site being a cancer healing center. It's a great use for that, I think. And it is a beautiful, spectacular setting. Approaching the age of 60, Patton has the trim build and spirited glow of a woman who pays attention to diet and exercise. "It's easy to eat organic in Bolinas," said Patton, who also takes advantage of miles of beaches right outside her door and nearby hiking trails that crisscross breathtaking vistas in Point Reyes National Seashore. She was raised on a Colorado ranch, and she likes to be outdoors. The bungalow she shares with her husband came with a spectacular garden. Patton enjoys tending the previous owner's legacy, adding more color and texture to the garden every year. She's always taken good care of herself, avoiding the pitfalls of drugs, booze, and tobacco that plagued others of her generation, especially fellow musicians. And it shows. She stands straight, which makes her look even taller than her 5'8". A short tassel of blonde hair frames blue eyes that twinkle, and a wide, slightly lopsided smile. Patton displays the energy of a woman half her age as an activist on issues of health and the environment. In 2001, in Stockholm, as a leader of a network of 350 organizations from around the world, Patton helped guide the UN's Persistent Organic Pollutants Treaty, which calls for the worldwide elimination of a dirty dozen list of chemical contaminants considered among the world's most hazardous. Intellectually, she understands as well as anyone the ubiquitous nature of chemical pollutants, but she didn't expect the emotional jolt she felt when she learned that her body was polluted with traces of 105 chemicals linked in animal studies to a list of devastating health effects, including cancer, disruption of the hormone system, birth deformities, and neurological impairments. "I don't live next door to a refinery or an incinerator or some kind of factory," said Patton, whose blood and urine were screened for chemical pollutants after she volunteered for a study conducted by Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York. "I've been careful, and it hasn't made a bit of difference in terms of the chemicals that are in my body." It turns out that what's in Patton is in every one of us. Unlike our forebears, everyone, everywhere now carries a dizzying array of chemical contaminants, the byproducts of modern industry and innovation. These toxic substances accumulate in our fat, bones, blood, and organs, or pass through us in breast milk, urine, feces, sweat, semen, hair, and nails. Scientists studying pollutants in people, including researchers at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, call the phenomenon chemical body burden. It's the consequence of womb-to-tomb exposures to substances so common in our daily lives that we never stop to consider them. That water-repellent jacket you're wearing, it got that way because of a chemical called perfluoroctanoic acid, or PFOA, which is used to make the fluoropolymer membranes needed to impart the extra utility. The Environmental Protection Agency, which has asked manufacturers to voluntarily reduce emissions of PFOA, is debating whether to officially describe the substance as likely to cause carcinogenicity in humans. That cute yellow bath toy your child or grandchild loves to chew, it's likely to contain plasticizers known as phthalates, which are part of a large family of industrial chemicals linked to impaired sperm quality in animals. That TV you spend hours in front of, it's probably made with a neurotoxic chemical flame retardant known as polybrominated diphenyl ether, which is showing up in the breast milk of U.S. mothers at rates 100 times the average found in European studies. In 2003, California followed the lead of the European Union and became the first state to ban two types of PBDEs. Other states have followed. But the most common type of PBDE, and the one found in televisions, is still in wide use. Scientists are worried that PBDEs disrupt the developing thyroid system and could cause developmental deficits. It's overwhelming what we're exposed to, said Jane Houlihan, Vice President of Research for the Environmental Working Group, a Washington, D.C.-based public advocacy organization that partnered in several biomonitoring studies. Every day we get a fresh flush of chemicals, she said. No place and no one is immune. The most persistent chemical contaminants are carried across oceans and continents by water and air. Like grasshoppers, they lift into the atmosphere, then glide back to Earth, moving from warmer climates to colder climates and settling thousands of miles from a contamination source. They're fat-soluble, and they biomagnify, increasing in concentration as they move up the food chain. They cross the placenta, so babies receive their first exposures in the womb. Indisputably, chemicals have helped raise our living standard and make our lives easier and safer. Think of the conveniences of plastic food storage containers, stain-resistant carpeting, sleek personal computers, and fast-cooking microwaves. Think of the security of fire-resistant materials, clean water supplies, stronger-than-steel bulletproof vests, and nylon seatbelts. Who can argue with the American Chemistry Council, a trade organization that represents Dow, DuPont, and hundreds of other chemical companies, when it suggests in a new advertising campaign that chemicals are essential to life? The slogan speaks volumes about the importance of the $637 billion a year U.S. industry. It's not that chemicals are bad per se, and it would be preposterous for even the most ardent environmentalist to suggest so. It's that costly societal problems often arise because we know so little about so many chemicals, and in the time it takes to learn what harm a substance is doing to people, to animals, to places, the genie is long out of the bottle. So that's how I start my book, and now I'm going to condense things a little for you. So what it comes down to is this. The United States doesn't have a viable means to keep its 300 million citizens safe from newfound chemical hazards in everyday things. The result of this policy failure is that chemicals known to interfere with the brain, body, and behavior at low levels of exposure are freely used in everything from plastics, soaps, and toys to food wrappers, clothing, and carpeting. Children receive their first exposures to hazardous chemicals while they're developing in the womb because the placenta is no barrier. Every child born today comes loaded with chemicals that may be contributing to various health problems that aren't apparent until later in life. And children receive additional doses through breast milk, the elixir of life. Hundreds of peer-reviewed studies show that traces of these endocrine-disrupting chemicals throw off test animals' hormone systems in various ways and alter gene expression. They cause lab animals to exhibit disorders and dysfunction that are on the rise in humans. The list is long, and it's frightening. It includes cancers of the breast, testicles, and brain, lowered sperm counts, early puberty in girls, endometriosis and other defects of the female reproductive system, diabetes, obesity, attention deficit disorder, asthma, and autism. And so going back to the CDC's biomonitoring work, the chemicals not only contaminate our air, water, and soil, but they're also inside us at levels that in some cases are uncomfortably close to the amounts that cause harmful effects in lab animals. So I want to be really clear about this next point. My review of the research shows that scientists are demonstrating through lab work and through animal studies a correlation between the human problems I just mentioned and the exposures to substances in our everyday things like polycarbonate plastic, grease-resistant food wrappings, baby lotions, and the housings of TV sets. Human epidemiological studies are beginning to confirm what the scientists see in lab animals. But at this point, one cannot say there is a direct cause and effect. In my book, I introduce you to scientists and public health advocates around the world who are looking at the animal findings and urging new limits on human exposures because of their very serious concerns. These are brilliant young scientists such as Berkeley Professor Tyrone Hayes, who was hired by Syngenta, the principal maker of the weed killer atrazine, to study the pesticide's effect on frogs. The chemical industry borrows from the public relations playbook of big tobacco to create public confusion and doubt over the findings of researchers such as Hayes. He discovered that as little as one part per billion of atrazine exposure is enough to sexually scramble frogs in his lab. In the U.S., it's okay to have 3 parts per billion of atrazine in drinking water. Atrazine is banned in the European Union, the corporate home of Syngenta, but it's widely used in the United States. The European Union and Canada are taking the lead in exercising precautionary actions on chemicals such as these based on a connect-the-dots method of identifying hazards. But this is not the case in the United States. Here we have a system where the EPA tries to manage chemicals through legislation known as the Toxic Substances Control Act. This legislation was passed way back in 1976, and the idea was to regulate the worst chemicals before they ever got into the commercial pipeline. It was a very good idea, but it hasn't worked out that way. And one of the first problems is that the legislation simply gave the green light to about 62,000 chemicals already in commerce when the act was passed more than 30 years ago. And second, where new chemicals are concerned, it didn't require manufacturers to test for toxicity or to measure exposure levels. So the EPA relies on not-so-reliable scientific models to predict the hazards of chemicals. And the EPA was put on a short leash from another perspective. Whatever action the EPA takes to restrict chemicals cannot create unnecessary barriers to business. In fact, the last time the EPA tried to regulate a substance was back in 1989, and that substance was asbestos. The restrictions put in place by the EPA were overturned by a federal appeals court because the EPA had not met the test of risk-benefit balancing in applying its actions. The bottom line is that toxics regulations in the United States put company profits before consumer protection at great expense to public health. Evaluators from the National Academy of Sciences to the General Accountability Office to the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment have weighed in on the inadequacies of this system, but we're still stuck with it. So as the evidence rolls in about the hazards in everyday things, about all the EPA can do is negotiate with chemical industry when it suspects a chemical of being a bad actor. And here's where the story comes back to microwave popcorn. The inside of a microwave popcorn bag is coated with a substance that as a byproduct of production results in a chemical known as PFOA. The coating is applied for grease protection, so after you pop the popcorn in the microwave, the oils don't seep through the bag onto your fingers or your clothes. PFOA and related perfluorinated chemicals that break down into it are used in the production of an enormous number of items for consumers. They're used in making nonstick coatings such as Teflon, stain-resistant applications for carpet and clothing, and they also work as a processing aid for making waterproof, breathable materials such as the Gore-Tex jackets I talked about in a few minutes ago. They're used in making plumber's tape and dental floss. In fact, the EPA says that virtually every industry has applications for perfluorinated chemicals. PFCs are very interesting to scientists and toxicologists because they have some truly eye-popping characteristics. First of all, they last forever in the environment. We've discovered some persistent, long-lived chemicals before, and we've banned or restricted them. In fact, the POPs treaty that Charles Patton worked on ushered in a worldwide ban. These are substances such as PCBs or polychlorinated biphenyls, which are the electrical insulators and coolants that we stopped manufacturing in the 1970s because they build up in the environment and can cause harmful health effects. PCBs are still measured in the environment and in people because they're so slow to break down, and they're in our food web. I know this firsthand because PCBs were present in my blood when I had it screened for pollutants as part of my research. But PFCs, I would suggest, are a thing beyond PCBs, and I apologize for the alphabet soup, because perfluorinated chemicals never break down. Every pound that's ever put into the environment will be there forever. And in people, they have a very long half-life, which means it takes years and years for a body to rid itself of PFCs, assuming that we never have another exposure. So, in reality, we're exposed to more PFCs than our bodies can ever get rid of. So let's just step back to gauge what scientists know for sure about perfluorinated chemicals. They're in human blood, breast milk, and umbilical cord blood collected from the world over. They're in places you'd expect to find them, like downstream from the manufacturing plants where they're made, and in places where you wouldn't, like the Arctic, because of the way they move in air and water. They're ubiquitous in people and in the environment, and what are we doing about it? After considering the research on PFOA, the EPA's Science Advisory Panel recommended listing it as a likely cancer-causing agent in humans. The EPA received this recommendation in 2005. It hasn't acted on it yet because it's still in the middle of a formal risk assessment on PFOA. As you remember from a moment ago, the EPA has had little success regulating chemicals, so it has asked the chemical industry to phase out production of PFOA by 2015. Meanwhile, the FDA, which oversees food additives, is looking at the situation because of how these chemicals are used in food wrappings. And toxicologists are holding meetings trying to figure out if, as the animal studies now suggest, low-dose developmental exposures to the chemicals are somehow contributing to obesity. Two preliminary epidemiological studies link low birth weight and body mass in newborn babies to very low levels of PFCs, and we're still exposed to this stuff every day. What the FDA researchers found may make you think very carefully about nuking the next bag of popcorn. Microwave popcorn bags contain a higher level of the chemical coating than any other product, and they get extremely hot extremely fast. So this may be why the concentration of chemicals migrating from the bags into the popcorn oil were hundreds of times higher than the amount of PFOA from heated nonstick cookware. So based on the concentrations measured by the scientists, consumption of 10 bags of microwave popcorn a year could contribute about 20% of the average PFOA blood level. So in reality, it's not the pans we should worry about, it's the paper. There are other substances we need to be concerned about, too. In fact, I've got a list of them, which is why I'm not too much fun to sit next to at a dinner party these days. I'm sure that many of you have heard about bisphenol A or BPA, the building block of polycarbonate plastic used in popular sport water bottles and in baby bottles. Just a few months ago, Canada banned polycarbonate plastic baby bottles because of the hazards of this chemical at everyday exposure levels. Nalgene and Camelback, the makers of brand name sport water bottles, have said they will no longer make their products using polycarbonate plastic. The makers of bisphenol A-free baby bottles can't make them fast enough to fill demand in Canada and even in the United States where we haven't banned it. So Walgreens and other major retailers have said they won't sell certain polycarbonate plastic products beginning next year. And it's really clear that consumers don't want these things in their products. So you may have heard that last month the FDA came to the reassuring conclusion that bisphenol A is perfectly safe as used. But the FDA relied on the findings from large industry-funded studies to declare that bisphenol A poses no problems. The FDA simply failed to consider the unique behavior of this estrogenic chemical at extremely low levels of exposure. In doing so, it dismissed the concerns of the National Toxicology Program, which is a federal research division of the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, which is around to advise the FDA. And it also dismissed the concerns of the world's leading BPA experts. Last year, 38 of these experts published a consensus statement in a peer-reviewed journal called Reproductive Toxicology. In it, they said that 95% of us have blood levels of BPA within a range predicted to be biologically active. Not all of this BPA is coming from sport bottles and baby bottles. BPA is used in the material that lines most metal food cans. The researchers warned that the adverse effects they have seen in more than 150 lab studies are of great concern because of the potential for similar effects in humans. And these are problems that correspond with recent trends in human diseases. And with BPA, these specific diseases are breast and prostate cancer, increases in neurogenital abnormalities in male babies, a decline in semen quality in men, early onset of puberty in girls, metabolic disorders leading to diabetes and obesity, and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So just last week, the first primate study on the effects of bisphenol A was reported by folks from Yale. And they saw an array of ill effects on brain function in monkeys exposed to levels of bisphenol A deemed safe by the EPA. And they only dosed the monkeys for 28 days to see these effects. So let's say the experts are only half right. Isn't that reason enough to get BPA out of our products, especially those intended for children? The FDA doesn't see it that way because it relies on a risk-based approach rather than one based on hazard identification. So the EPA is betting the odds that BPA is not a problem, in spite of what the experts say and in spite of a determination by the Federal National Toxicology Program that the possibility that BPA may alter human development cannot be dismissed. So occasionally, the realities about the hazards of endocrine-disrupting chemicals get through to our policymakers. This was the case recently with another family of chemicals. They're called phthalates, and they're extremely versatile. As you know, here in Washington, they're in toys, baby products, and lotions, cosmetics, personal care products, fragrances, air fresheners, medical tubing and blood bags, PVC piping, pharmaceuticals, and car parts. They are ubiquitous in our daily environment and in people, including pregnant women and fetuses. Biomonitoring studies show that levels of exposure warrant concern. Humans are exposed to the same multiple phthalates and mixtures of phthalates that have cumulative effects in rats. In male lab rats developing in the womb, phthalates contribute to toxic effects of the reproductive system, including birth defects of the penis, infertility, and cancer. And there are reasons to suspect that this phthalate syndrome seen in rats might provide some clues about the increases in human male reproductive abnormalities. Last month, Congress passed sweeping reforms to the Consumer Product Safety Act, which included new standards for toys. Part of this legislation calls for a ban on six kinds of phthalates. It's definitely a good start, but it doesn't call for banning phthalates in baby lotions and personal care products, which is another route of exposure. And as far as the FDA is concerned, phthalates are just fine. The FDA's legal authority over cosmetics and personal care products is different from its authority over drugs and medical devices. Cosmetics and personal care ingredients are not subject to pre-market approval, and the FDA isn't authorized to substantiate safety claims. The FDA oversees $1 trillion a year of food, drug, medical devices, and cosmetics. But its own science advisory panel has concluded that it's suffering from serious deficiencies that put American lives at risk. I have one small example. I submitted a Freedom of Information Act request to find out about the workings of the Office of Color and Cosmetics, which is within the FDA and which oversees the sale of $50 billion a year worth of personal care products. So what I found out, I thought was truly outrageous. The Office of Color and Cosmetics has 30 employees and a budget of $3.4 million, and that's about the same as it was two decades ago. So in Portland, where I live, the office that controls 989 traffic signals has 40 employees and a budget of $22 million. So you can see the low priority of this federal watchdog office. Before I wrap up and get to your questions, I want to tell you about one more family of chemicals that we're exposed to through our everyday things. These are chemicals that are familiar to many of you in the room because Washington has acted on them. And they're the flame retardants known as polybrominated diphenyl ethers, or PBDEs. So structurally, they're very similar to PCBs, which I mentioned were banned in the 70s. And PBDEs, which were introduced in the 70s, are very persistent, and they increase in concentration as they move up the food chain. So PBDEs were added to items such as drapes, carpeting, furniture upholstery, and the plastic casings of electronics. Researchers began taking notice of them in the 90s when they saw significant increases of PBDEs in human breast milk. And in the United States, the levels of PBDEs in breast milk are significantly higher than in other developed countries because we've used more of these flame retardants than anywhere else.
You're listening to Nana Baker on The Body Toxic. This is Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling our toll-free number, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
The good news is the types of PBDEs used in drapes, mattresses, carpeting, and upholstered furniture were voluntarily taken off the market in 2004 because of health and exposure concerns. But that's tempered by two facts. First of all, most of us have furniture and carpeting and mattresses and other big-ticket things in our homes, in our offices, that date back well before 2004. And second, the most widely used PBDE flame retardant, DECA, is still on the market in places other than Washington for application in electronics, principally. So several states have moved to ban all PBDEs because less hazardous alternatives and methods are available. And you can find lists of products free from PBDEs by checking out resources online, such as the Green Guide and the Environmental Working Group. But in the meantime, there's some work out there suggesting that PBDE exposure is contributing to an epidemic of hyperthyroidism in house cats. Cats like to snuggle up next to nice, warm electronics. And cats, just like children, spend a lot of time on the floor, and they have an abundance of mouthing behaviors that make them susceptible to ingesting dust and dirt loaded with PBDEs. The bottom line with respect to these flame retardants is that they may be the PCBs of the 21st century. And like the other chemicals I've talked about today, we're exposed to them daily. So there are now proposals before the state of California and the U.S. Congress that would greatly improve the status quo with respect to how we use and manage toxic chemicals in our everyday things. These overhauls would safeguard our children and our grandchildren from the error of our ways. That's the big picture. But what about personal choices? We can't shop our way clear of this problem, but we can make more informed choices. Based on my own research, I've sworn off microwave popcorn, I've thrown out all the plastic storage containers in my kitchen, and I've learned to say no to optional stain and water-resistant treatments offered when I go out and buy those big-ticket items such as carpeting and furniture. And I vacuum more because so many of these pollutants end up in dust. And I want to thank you so much for your attention, and I'm very happy to take your questions.
Did you ever get a chance to talk to any of these industry people? You know, and I realize, you know, if you talk to their lawyers or if you talk to their PR people or their paid scientists, you know, you get a different story. But if you talk to maybe people that are on the boards of these corporations and stuff, you know, maybe they are human, you know, because their children are getting these chemicals and stuff too. So I'm just kind of curious about that.
Yeah, I did have some conversations with people who, you know, were not sort of the designated spokesperson. And my sense from those conversations is that These people truly believe that low-level exposures are just a fact of life and are not a problem. And they rely on that old adage that the dose makes the poison, and they don't believe or want to believe or accept that this whole theory of low-dose exposures to endocrine-disrupting substances can have effects that are more serious and of more concern than, you know, higher doses. And so, you know, I think there's a way to see the world through that prism. It's not the best way, I think, or in terms of what we know from the research and in terms of all that, you know, science has to offer right now. But, yeah, I don't see these people as you know, just terribly cruel and insensitive. I just see them as believing in something that is really no longer on the table scientifically.
How about the frying pans with Teflon? I use those as very convenient things to be using. And if they're the same material that's in the popcorn bags, is that what you said? And is there? I'd like to think there's less toxic material there that I can continue using them. And my other question is, why is it that we're always the, you know, is it our commercialism is so tied in with our living that we can't look at our public health?
Okay. Well, let me try to answer the question about the nonstick Teflon type pans. It does seem, the research shows that you're going to get greater exposures from food wrappings and like microwave popcorn. There are also pizza boxes and some bakery wrappings, things that have a coating that are designed to prevent, you know, grease from coming through. But, you know, there's some concern about using the nonstick cookware if it's overheated, especially. And actually, if you go on DuPont's website, they actually talk about how toxic very highly heated pans are to birds. And so people who are into birds and have birds as pets have known this for a long time. There's, you know, if you have birds in your house, be really careful with this stuff too. You know, I've now moved away from using nonstick cookware, and I've gone to other materials. And you know, I can't advise you on what to do, but I do think that you know, there are some concerns, and also in the fact that in the production of the nonstick cookware, you know, we're emitting this chemical, and it's getting into the environment and ending up in the Arctic and ending up, you know, contaminating cultures that aren't into Teflon, you know, the Inuit. So, it is kind of a dilemma. And your other question was about why it's taking us so long to kind of get on board. Well, I think, you know, some of the whole notion of low dose exposures being a problem kind of came to the fore about 10 years ago, and it's taken a few years since then to kind of sort it out and, you know, really get to a point where there's wide acceptance now that this truly occurs. And so for a long time there was some debate about, well, you know, is this really something we should worry about? These low-level exposures, are they enough to cause concern? And I think now, you know, the science has really been building, and so, you know, for whatever reasons, the Europeans and the Canadians have decided that they're going to move in a precautionary direction, and in the United States, you know, we're still with this risk-based system. I do see some of that changing. There's a proposal, the Kids Safe Chemical Act at the federal level, would change some of the way that we deal with chemicals in a very significant way, and California also has some legislation that would help in that regard too, in sort of a broader way of managing chemicals in consumer products overall. So compared with when I started this process of researching about 4 years ago, the movement has been significant, and I'm very optimistic that we are seeing some changes.
I was wondering what's being used to replace these products, in the, these chemicals in the products, and then are there any known side effects of what's being used to replace them?
Yeah, there are, well, for example, on the perfluorinated chemicals, 3M was the manufacturer of most of the perfluorinated chemicals that were made in the United States up until the year 2000. And they used them in their Scotchgard line of like stain protectors and water repellents and things like that. And in 2000, they went through a process, a painful process, of taking the Scotchgard line off the market and reformulating. And they did this because they saw the widespread contamination of the population with this particular chemical. I mean, it was they found it when they went to a Red Cross blood bank looking for samples that would be clean, because they wanted to use those in a worker study that they were conducting, and all of a sudden they realized they couldn't find any clean samples anywhere. So then they started to look at the toxicity a little more, and anyway, they moved away from it. And interestingly, when they did that, DuPont didn't have a supplier for the perfluorinated chemicals that they needed, so they started making it themselves at that moment, after knowing that 3M was moving away for various reasons. But this is a long answer to your question, which is they've moved to a related chemical that has a shorter carbon chain, and it seems to be less toxic. And this tends to happen with you know, a number of substitutes. You just don't know for sure, but most of, you know, I think when companies do decide that they're going to move away from something, and there's so much intense pressure on the old chemical or intense scrutiny of the old chemical, they are looking really, really carefully at the new one for what they can ferret out about toxicology and exposure problems. So it's, you know, it's not a perfect way of working, you know, trying to replace things that have been out for a long time with these newer things and hope for the best. But I think we are learning more about the replacements, and what we do know, you know, is more reassuring.
I'm just curious, are these chemicals in regular plasticware, like, you know, mixing bowls or Tupperware and that kind of stuff, or are we... Are they different categories?
Well, that's a really good question. It's sometimes really hard to know what kind of plastic you're dealing with, because there really isn't much labeling. And some people try to, you know, figure it out by the recycling triangles on the bottom. And number 7 triangle, polycarbonate plastic is always number 7. But number 7s can also be other things, including the new and supposedly better replacements for bisphenol A or polycarbonate-derived plastic, polycarbonate plastic. So it is really tough to figure out. But if you're curious and you know the name of the manufacturer, you can always contact them. I've been doing a lot of that lately, just, you know, emailing businesses when I have a question, and they usually do get back to you within a day or two. And so, yeah, the onus is on the consumer, unfortunately. And if you're concerned, just, you know, you have to do the research.
Two questions here. One's really basic about animal testing. When a new product, a new chemical is invented and developed, does it have to be tested, first of all? And does it, I guess it has to be tested on a critter that's given enough of it till it gets sick and has symptoms in it. Is there any better way?
Well, yeah, the European Union is really sensitive to the whole, I mean, much more so even than we are to animal testing. And I do believe that there are some methods that have to do with testing or relying on the results from chemicals that are very similar. So in that way they can not have to use as many animals. But the best method for getting the idea of results is through animal studies.
After the fact.
Yeah.
Okay, one other different question. Did anybody make problems for you and say, no, we don't want you to put this into print?
Well, no, I think that most people who make chemicals and sell these products kind of want their side of the story to be heard and told. And the only situation I had where I wasn't able to talk to a representative of a company who I really wanted to talk to was when I let DuPont know that I was working on the book and that I had a chapter about perfluorinated chemicals. And so the spokesperson who I was dealing with asked for a list of some of the questions that I wanted to ask. And I emailed the list. And after reading the list, which included the questions about why did you begin making PFOA after 3M got out of the business, they wouldn't talk to me. So, you know, that was the only experience that I had.
Has there been any marketing research or psychology research that helps in the marketing against confusion and doubt with something that nobody has? You don't have a direct relationship or an obvious relationship with chemicals, like they're just something you don't see. So how do people change their behaviors or their thinking with something that they don't have a direct relationship, like an obvious direct relationship with, visually or smelling or anything like that?
Yeah, it is tough. I mean, that's part of the problem. The chemicals that I talk about in my book, you know, they don't have a taste or a smell, or, you know, they're not sending people to emergency rooms, but you know, there's pretty good reason to be concerned that they may be contributing to, you know, infertility problems and lowered sperm quality and developmental issues and, you know, a number of things that are of a very high cost to society. So I don't know the answer to that. I think what's happening is people have realized that if you make the discussion about children, and if you could somehow connect these substances and the harm that they do to the fetus and very young children, you can at least narrow the discussion somewhat. And so that's kind of where we are now with the Kids Safe Chemical Act.
You mentioned that there's one way that the United States tests or has decided to evaluate these harmful chemicals, and that Europe and Canada uses another method. I'm not clear. The words don't sound very different, but they obviously are very different in their result. Could you talk a little bit about those two methods?
Yeah. Well, Canada and the European Union are using the data that comes out of the research about the hazards that are identified. And then they set set a priority list, or they come up with a priority list of what they consider to be the most dangerous chemicals. And then they've said to, at least in the European Union, they've said, okay, show us the data about toxicity for your chemical, which we consider to be persistent, bioaccumulative, and toxic. And if we see the data and it really isn't what we think it is, then yeah, you can have access to the market. And if it is a problem, then you're going to need to come up with an alternative. What we do in the United States is we do these risk assessments that are based on, you know, looking for the effects of certain doses. And sometimes, you know, they can take years to complete these kinds of studies, and they do miss some of the really low dose effects that are of concern, that are, you know, really emerging as you know, pretty serious reasons to be concerned about bisphenol A and perfluorinated chemicals and flame retardants and so on. So I hope that makes it a little more clear.
I wonder if you could tell us some of your favorite resources for researching things, like let's say you're going to remodel your house or something. You know, how could you find out what the best, carpet that you could buy that wouldn't be toxic to the environment and you, or, you know, things like that? Where would you go if you
wanted to find
out?
Well, I mean, you can start online with the Green Guide, and the Environmental Working Group has, you know, a lot of different databases. And if you're interested in personal care products, there's the Safe Cosmetics campaign that is partners with the Environmental Working Group, and they have a database of something like 25,000 different personal care products. So you can type in the one that you use now and see what kind of chemicals are in it. And it's really interesting that there are these kind of third parties that are doing this work, but it's great because no one else is. And so, yeah, you can start online, and then, you know, if you there are some books that are out there as well that are really about, you know, just greener construction, or, you know, I mean, there you can get as narrow as you want to go.
Hi, I have a question about the testing approaches. You're talking about chemicals almost in isolation. It's this chemical, this chemical, this chemical. What about in combination? I know that there's some tests, but it seems like what we're not taking into consideration is the fact that we've got 36, 101, mm-hmm. whatever in our bodies.
Yeah, it's a really tough research question, and some of the concerns about phthalates are that they do seem to have a cumulative effect. And so, you know, being exposed to a number of them as we are. Yeah, it's very, very tough to do that kind of research. And now I think there's also some preliminary work that's just getting underway about how phthalates and bisphenol A are, how they might work together. And in terms of pesticides, there's some work going on as well about combinations of pesticides. So, yeah, we do. We look at these substances in isolation, and that's not the real world exposures to these things. So that's a whole another level, a whole new level that research is going to have to get to, and it may take some new technologies, all sorts of things that, you know, just aren't readily accessible yet.
I'm curious to know your idea about what's happening in the research labs of these corporations and universities. Now I think we're more focusing on acts and things that to prevent what's happening, like the popcorn thing you said is already out on the market, but there are innovations and products being developed in these labs, and what's happening there? How can we be certain that things coming up being developed in the future wouldn't cause things like this, what the things you are saying?
Well, I don't think there is 100% certainty. You know, when 3M came out with its replacement line of Scotch Guard, for example, you know, they went through the most rigorous testing they could, and it cost a lot of money. And they were very determined not to put something out there that was going to have the same problems that these longer C8 chains of C8 types of perfluorochemicals had. So, you know, there isn't ever 100% certainty, but there certainly is a lot of pressure and a lot of awareness and, you know, a lot of scrutiny when replacements come out. So the argument against replacing something is often, well, we don't know what the effects will be. And I think in some ways that it's true, but, you know, what the examples that we've seen so far that I've just talked about with 3M and so forth, they really want to make sure that they're going to replace it with something better. So there is a lot of pressure, as I said, to clean it up.
I just thought of this at the end because it relates to my background in biology and botany, but what about natural chemicals? There are so many in insects and plants and whatever that are already out there in the environment. Rather than being the controllers we are and trying to invent these new biochemicals, why aren't we utilizing for our purposes existing chemicals that we can discover in the environment already?
Well, there's a whole movement going on called green chemistry. And there's green chemistry departments cropping up at universities around the country, some really, really smart people who are pushing very hard to make sure that chemists are, you know, aware that, you know, they've got to think about the toxicology of the things that they're creating rather than just, you know, the application. So there is a movement in that direction, and the whole idea is, you know, first do no harm. Come up with chemical substances that are inherently benign. Thanks for your great questions.
You were just listening to Nana Baker on The Body Toxic. She spoke at Town Hall in Seattle in September 2008. Nana Baker, an award-winning investigative reporter, is the author of The Body Toxic. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an unembedded award-winning weekly series based in Boulder, Colorado. We offer AR free to all public and community radio stations in the United States and the rest of the world. We are independent. Our sole source of financial support comes directly from listeners just like you. AR features such voices as Vandana Shiva, Maud Barlow, Eric Schlosser, Robert Fisk, Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, and Naomi Klein. To access our vast audio catalog and to find out about subscribing to AR so you don't miss a single program, we offer CD, MP3, and printed transcript subscriptions, go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for a CD, MP3, or written transcript of the program you just heard, Nana Baker on The Body Toxic, call us toll-free at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that toll-free number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our secure website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Ed Mays recorded the program. Series 3 music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. Stephanie Brown is our editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with John Coltrane, Saida's Song Flute.
Hi, Ed Goldberg here. Movie Talk is moving. I am the host of Movie Talk. We will be moving to Fridays at 11:30, the first and third Fridays of the month, starting on March 6th. With my colleagues DK Holm and Don Taylor, we will discuss films, big films, classic films, DVD releases, anything we can. And please follow us to Fridays at 11:30, first and third Fridays of the month, for Movie Talk.
Would you like to help Cable Community Radio grow and prosper? Do you have an interest in nonprofit finances and operations? We have a job opening for finance coordinator. This is a 30-hour per week position with full benefits, including medical. Starting pay is $18 to $22 per hour. You will work with staff, volunteers, and CPAs to support KBU through account management, financial analysis, and reporting. For a full description, please visit kbu.fm/employment. Resume, cover letter, and application are required. If you have any questions, please email station manager Arthur Davis at manager@kbu.org. The deadline for applications is Friday, March 20th, 5 p.m. We look forward to hearing from you.
International Women's Day is heading our way, and Broad Arts Theater is presenting its 7th annual International Women's Day concert, sponsored by the City of Portland's Vision into Action project. It's happening this Friday, March 6th, from 5 to 6:30 p.m. It's at City Hall, 1221 Southwest 4th Avenue, and it is free. So, laugh, sing, and celebrate with your sisters, mothers, boyfriends, friends, spouses, significant others, extended family, housemates, shipmates, hipmates, and soulmates. That's this Friday, March 6th, from 5 to 6:30 p.m. at Portland City Hall. Brought to you by the fine people of Broad Art.
Black Book Talk, KBOO's monthly program on books by black authors, moves to a new day and time this week. Hear Black Book Talk at its new day and time this Thursday at 11:30 a.m. when hosts Patricia, O.B., and Emma interview author E. Lynn Harris.
I'm very much in tune as to what it is that I do now, you know, and I'm a writer. I think one of the things you have to do as a writer is be prepared to let the characters come in and tell their story.
That's E. Lynn Harris this Thursday at 11:30 a.m. on Black Book Talk right here on KBOO.
And it is just a few seconds before 10 a.m. right here on KBOO in Portland. And coming up, it's Air Cascadia with news commentary and commentary hosted by Chris Andre and Liam Delta at 10:15 on Flashpoints. Marjorie Cohen of the National Lawyers Guild discusses recent documents that implicate many officials in the Bush administration in crimes of torture. And at 11, it's the Bike Show. Today, celebrate amazing bicyclists. Learn more about local bike heroes and the upcoming Alice B. Toklips Award ceremony that will honor their good work.
Good morning, Cascadia. You're listening to your community radio station, KBOO Portland, Oregon, at 90.7 FM. Today is Wednesday, March 4th, and this is Air Cascadia, long on content, short on time. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Liam Delta.
Moving forward, the LNG Public Protection Act was formally introduced yesterday.
In Montana, the W.R. Grace defense insists the company was just following EPA instructions.
Sadly enough, that's probably true.
Yeah.
A split U.S. Supreme Court yesterday indicated it may narrowly rule a West Virginia Supreme Court justice improperly participated in court decisions overturning a $50 million judgment against the A.T. Massey Coal Company.
Portland area weather, we're in between storms today. Rain's not likely. Temperatures in the low 50s. Tonight, cloudy. Temperatures in the 30s. And then tomorrow, rain is likely.
And first up, regional news from around Cascadia. The LNG, Public Protection Act, was formally introduced yesterday. The bill number is HB 2015. This Friday, though, a front group for the LNG industry. Let's keep that in mind. They've come up with their own so-called grassroots group, Energy Action Northwest. They're going to be holding an open house and lobby day at the Capitol building. The purpose of their presence there is to convince legislators to oppose the LNG Public Protection Act. Olivia Schmidt with Columbia Riverkeeper joins us this morning to talk about HB 2015 and also this appearance of Energy Action Northwest on the radar. Thanks for being with us, Olivia.
Thanks, Chris. Yeah, we're very happy that the LNG Public Protection Act has come to the floor. It's House Bill 2015, as you mentioned. The bill is not a ban on LNG, but it does strengthen the state's role in the permitting process. The two key things that the bill does is demand that there be a proven need in the state of Oregon for LNG prior to granting permits for, you know, not only the use of our natural resources like the 15 billion gallons of Columbia River water that Bradwood Landing wants to use each year for operation, but also to the other thing that it does that's really important is it demands that the LNG would meet our global warming standards in the state. So basically, the high carbon impact would be considered. The third thing that it does is it requires that the LNG terminals could not be sited in an area that would diminish beneficial existing public uses of waterways, like agricultural use of water, commercial fishing. If any of those things were to be disrupted, they wouldn't be allowed to receive their permit. So it's a really exciting bill. It gives the state a little bit more strength in its permitting process. Unfortunately, this group, Energy Action Northwest, which is a front group for the LNG organization that has mirrored its messaging on the anti-LNG coalition, the grassroots organization, which is primarily made up of, you know, farmers and foresters, impacted landowners, people who are concerned about climate change and are proponents of energy independence. So Energy Action Northwest, this LNG front group, is doing a lobby day on Friday, and the Anti-LNG Coalition is holding a call-in day of action. So anyone out there who's listening who would like to contact their legislator, their House representative or state senator on Friday to urge support for House Bill 2015, I strongly encourage folks to make that call. It's relatively simple to find out who your legislator is. You can just, you know, Google the state of Oregon and navigate through the state's webpage to find a link that says Find Your Legislator.
So
the more calls that we get that day, the better it will be as this Energy Action Northwest is out there propagating the myth that we're all a bunch of, you know, radical environmental extremists, when in fact we're day-to-day citizens who are really concerned about climate change and energy independence.
So do we know any particular people, individuals associated with Energy Action Northwest or funding
well,
sources?
Yeah, their head guy is a man named Ed Finkley, who has direct relation to the LNG industry. He frequently goes to local events and speaks on behalf of the LNG industry. You know, their tagline is LNG is the blue bridge to the green future. It's just, you know, more of this wordsmithing to trick people into believing that LNG is somehow a clean fuel, which it is not.
Well, if they could come up with a name like that, you'd think they'd have done something about the word Finkley. Anyway, thank you so much, Olivia, for that. That, of course, is Olivia Schmidt with Columbia River Keeper. Thank you.
Conservationists hope President Obama's new direction on the Endangered Species Act will derail the BLM's plan to increase logging in Western Oregon. Obama announced yesterday that rather than follow rules adopted by the Bush administration giving them discretion, federal agencies should consult with federal biologists when a project might harm endangered species. Given that the trees produce the air we breathe, maybe we should preserve the forest lest we become the next endangered species.
Right, next up to bat. We have a little bit more, a few more specifics on what the Obama administration's environmental side is going to look like. The president announced plans yesterday to resume full scientific reviews of projects that might harm endangered wildlife and plants. The president signed a memorandum putting on hold a Bush administration regulation allowing agencies to avoid scientific reviews. During a visit to the Interior Department, Obama said that the review process had been undermined by past administrations. And how?
Dry winter weather in southern Oregon is affecting the rivers. The Rogue River has been running lower than normal for most of this year, with precipitation below average for 9 straight months. As of last week, less than 1,000 winter steelhead had crossed Gold Ray Dam because of the low flows, well below the average. The mountain snowpack in the Rogue and Umpqua River basins also remains low at 86% of average.
Sage grouse populations are vulnerable for many reasons, including cattle water troughs that can trap and drown birds. State biologists have come up with a quick, easy solution. No, not remove cattle from wildlife habitat. Biologists at the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife came up with this, a metal ramp that helps the animals get out of the trough once they fall in. But let's not disturb the cattle.
Yeah. A bill moving through Congress that would give D.C. a voting representative in the House may also rebound to Oregon's political benefit. Cue the experts. The experts say the bill would increase the odds that Oregon will get a 6th congressional seat after the 2010 census. It also boosts Washington State's somewhat slimmer chances of getting an extra seat in the House. And climate refugees vote.
They do. And there's going to be a lot more of them. Growth, you know, only it's not going to be the kind of upper middle class, upscale, spend money at coffee shops type growth. It's going to be a lot scarier. A play banned from La Grande High School will instead be done at Eastern Oregon University. After the president said that she had no choice but to allow a student group to rent space for the performance. The play in question, in case anyone wants to check it out, is Steve Martin's Picasso at La Panne Agile. But a professor on behalf of the Student Democrats Club at EOU offered to host the play, so the show goes on.
In Washington State, an environmental group is challenging a permit issued to the State Department of Transportation regulating how the agency manages stormwater runoff from state highways. The Puget Soundkeeper Alliance says the state can and should retrofit its highways to prevent runoff from going directly into rivers and streams, and the permit should have required this. Untreated stormwater is a main source of pollution for Puget Sound and other western Washington waters.
With regard to the previous story, one can only imagine the fun that Steve Martin himself would have with this brouhaha in Eastern Oregon. After overseeing a company at the very center of the still imploding U.S. housing market, this story should be called The Very Nerve. A dozen former countrywide executives are now poised to make millions
from the mortgage crisis. When you got lemons, make lemonade, I guess is their philosophy. Stanford Curlin, the former president of Countrywide Financial and a gaggle of cronies from the now defunct firm, are running a company called PennyMac. The company specializes in, wait for it, buying up bad home mortgages that the U.S. government took over from other failed banks.
An arsonist is on the prowl in Medford for green Ford Escorts from the 1990s. Three of them have been burned in recent weeks, a series that Medford Police Sergeant Mike Boudreau describes as pretty bizarre.
No comment. President Barack Obama's push to reset U.S.-Russian relations took a huge stride when he signaled this week that to the Kremlin that he might forego his anti-missile system in Eastern Europe if Moscow uses its clout with the troublesome Iran and its nuclear ambitions. The back-channel diplomatic gambit was one of the few tools that Obama had for unknotting the stalemated relationship. I wouldn't say it's unknotted by a long stretch, but that's just my opinion. The relationship, though, has in fact suffered under Bush, and one can only imagine what the back-channel memoranda consisted of. Good morning, Spencer.
Good morning, Chris.
What do you see in this type of diplomacy? Is this the best way to go? Is it the only way to go? And really, are we walking straight into a typical Vladimir Putin sort of trap?
Well, it's really interesting that Obama should, make a proposal like this. It looks like it was a memo from in January that Obama, just as you said, offered to stop the weapons defense programs in Eastern Europe, probably specifically the Kaliningrad facility, in exchange if Russia would be willing to help with the nuclear position of Iran. And if you think about this just in itself, this is probably the most conciliatory gesture from the United States to the Kremlin, I don't know, in a long time, if not ever. This is basically an outstretched hand saying, look, Putin, we can work together on this Iran front, and, the United States is willing to succeed. It's interesting, though, that this should come from Obama, not Hillary Clinton, who, as Secretary of State, is theoretically the chief foreign diplomacy officer for the United States. There's been nothing out of the State Department or Hillary Clinton's office there as to what they think about this, if they had any part in this. As for Putin and the Kremlin in general, there's been no response. We don't know if they even took that seriously, if they received it, and what is happening, if anything, along that front.
Thank you so much for that, Spencer. We'll wait and see how this one turns out. We've got just a couple of really important stories before we close this program. So let's very, very briefly just give us a headline, Liam.
A group of U.S. lawmakers upset by frivolous government spending on projects announced they want to give President Obama line item veto over budgets.
In Missoula, Montana, the W.R. Grace Company trial is underway. Defense lawyers said that based on EPA instructions, Grace was not required to provide documents that had been requested. It's going to be a long trial, and don't hold your breath, especially if you live in Montana.
The A.T. Massey Coal Company bought a judge who overturned a judgment against them, and now the U.S. Supreme Court may overturn that judge. This has been Headlines and Commentary from Air Cascadia for Wednesday, March 4th, 2009. Today's editor is Chris Andre. Engineering is Kate Welsh. The KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Chris Andre. You're listening to member-supported KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM. Your support and your support only keeps us subverting the dominant paradigm. Thank you so much, members.
Coming up next, flashpoints. Marjorie Cohen from the National Lawyers Guild talks about recent documents implicating Bush administration officials in torture.
Thanks for listening and have a good day.
Countdown Flashpoints will report on the donors' conference in Egypt, where Hillary Clinton doesn't miss a beat continuing the Bush policy for Palestine, as Israel prepares to double its settler population in the occupied West Bank. Also, National Lawyers Guild President Marjorie Cohen comments on newly released Justice Department documents that further implicate Bush legal officials, including John Yoo, in a wide-ranging program of torture. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And now from exile in New York City, the Night Report with Robert Knight.
In today's Night Report, from Pakistan, a new Taliban in the West and an un-cricket attack in the East. I'm Robert Knight in New York. The Sri Lankan cricket team was the target of a lethal grenade attack today by a dozen gunmen who killed eight bystanders and wounded seven cricketers in Pakistan's second largest city of Lahore. That's the capital of the Punjabi province bordering India in eastern Pakistan. Following a fierce gunfight with Pakistani police, the attackers retreated, leaving behind undetonated explosives. They were still at large as of deadline. The attack by an as yet unidentified organization has precipitated international condemnations and the cancellations of other team visits, as well as threatening Pakistan's planned co-hosting of the 2011 Cricket World Cup. That event has been credited with easing diplomatic and military tensions between Pakistan and India, its co-nuclear neighbor to the east. Further west, there's a new militia alliance emerging in Pakistan's tribal territories near the border with Afghanistan. That's where the various Taliban factions headed by Baitullah Massoud, Maulvi Nazir, and Gul Bahadur have recently united in order to expel NATO and American forces from neighboring Afghanistan. As part of the tactical detente against the Afghan occupation, the three warlords are curtailing attacks on the Pakistani army, as most recently reflected in the Swat Valley peace agreement between the militias and the government in Islamabad. The alliance bodes ill for President Obama's imminent surge into Afghanistan because it adheres to the admonition of the spiritual leader of the Afghan Taliban, Mullah Omar, who recently urged Pakistani militants to stop fighting at home in order to join the battle to, quote, liberate Afghanistan from the occupation forces, end quote. Meanwhile, unlike the United States, key NATO nations are apparently losing their stomach for an endless war in Afghanistan. Today, the French Defense Minister Hervé Morin called for a timetable for the withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan. But it's not just the French who don't want to fight. The Afghanistan quagmire has earned a two-thirds disapproval rating among Canadian voters, as well as in Germany, where public concern is growing over a warning issued by Taliban commander Mullah Salam, who recently stated that, quote, "We will exact revenge for every innocent Afghan killed, and we will continue the holy war until we have driven the Germans out of Kunduz and all other occupiers out of Afghanistan," end quote. And that's some of the news of this Tuesday, March 3rd, 2009. From exile in New York, I'm Robert Knight for Flashpoints.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Yesterday, the Justice Department released nine national security legal opinions written by the Bush administration, which revealed that in the weeks before President George W. Bush left office, an administration attorney had disavowed all of the decisions apparently made after 9/11 in the context eventually of the Patriot Act. Joining us to talk about the significance of these new memos and what they all have to do with a man by the name of John Yoo is our good friend Marjorie Cohen. She is the president of the National Lawyers Guild and the author of the soon-to-be-released Rules of Disengagement, The Politics and Honor of Military Dissent. Marjorie Cohen, welcome back to Flashpoints.
My pleasure, Dennis.
Well, it's good to have you again. First of all, give us a brief thumbnail sketch of what the new memos mean and suggest.
Well, it's quite amazing. I mean, we had seen some of the prior memos, the John Yoo, Jay Bybee memos, where they purported to to basically insulate the Bush administration from any prosecution for torture, redefining torture. But these memos go even further in many respects. John Yoo, who is the author or co-author of some of these memos, and Jay Bybee, a federal court judge, also author of one or more of these memos, talk about things like the Fourth Amendment won't apply to any domestic military operations. In other words, if the president thinks that there's a terrorist in a house in the United States, even a U.S. citizen, he can authorize the police to just barge in, or the military to barge in and with guns blazing and search and seize and arrest people without even going to a judge. In other words, the Fourth Amendment wouldn't apply. There's also another astounding assertion in one of these memos where John Yoo, who is one of the co-authors of the memo, it was dated October 23rd, 2001, suggested that the president could even suspend the Fourth Amendment, freedom of speech and freedom of press, if he thought it was necessary to wage the so-called war on terror. And you wrote, First Amendment speech and press rights may also be subordinated to the overriding need to wage war successfully. In that memo, John Yoo essentially said that the United States was in a state of armed conflict. And he said the scale of violence was unprecedented, and legal and constitutional rules governing law enforcement, such as the Fourth Amendment prohibition on unreasonable searches and seizures, didn't apply. Another one of the memos, one written by Jay Bybee, the federal court judge, now, of course, rewarded for his role in these memos with a plum spot on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, was dated March 13, 2002, and it basically gives the green light to extraordinary rendition. He concluded that the president can transfer al-Qaeda and Taliban prisoners anywhere, to any country they want, and as long as they don't intend that the person be tortured in that third country, then there's no restriction. He says the torture convention doesn't apply, and we know from speaking before, Dennis, that the torture convention says that no exceptional circumstances whatsoever, whether a state of war or a threat of war, internal political instability, or any other public emergency may be invoked as a justification for torture. But the torture convention also says that no country can expel, return, or extradite a person to another country where there are substantial grounds for believing that he would be in danger of being subjected to torture. Jay Bybee writes in this March 13, 2002 memo that the torture convention doesn't apply extraterritorially, which is an astounding assertion. So this was one, and then what happened, and there are there are too many egregious things to go over in the short amount of time we had, but one of the things that John Yoo and his co-author Delahunty did was to say that, because the law recognizes self-defense, legitimate self-defense, therefore the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply. because we're basically defending ourselves against these people who are attacking us in the country right now in this state of war. Now, it is true that we had terrorist attacks, horrific attacks on 9/11 that killed 3,000 people in New York and in Pennsylvania. But nobody, I think, in their right mind would say that we are in a state of war. And so he's saying because we have a right to self-defense, then we can suspend the Fourth Amendment because we're defending ourselves against the terrorists. Now, that's the same kind of reasoning that Bush used with his preemptive war strategy, saying, we're acting in self-defense here by going into Iraq. and Afghanistan. The law of self-defense, and I know because I teach criminal law, requires that there be a reason, the person exercising self-defense have a reasonable belief in the need to defend against death or great imminent death or great bodily injury. And there's no showing that that the terrorists are imminently going to attack us. So, I mean, just these memos basically inform the Bush administration that there are no limits at all on the president in suspending the Constitution. Now, interestingly, a couple of months before Bush left office, this was in on October 6th, 2008, and then again on January 15th, 2009, the Bush administration's Office of Legal Counsel of the Department of Justice issued two memos basically rescinding all of these prior memos, saying we didn't really mean it, we weren't really following them anyway, and it was the classic cover your ass, excuse my French, classic, saying, well, you know, the legal reasoning, and it not really criticizing the legal reasoning, but saying for, you know, for various reasons, you know, we shouldn't rely on them, and disavowing them. Now, I believe we've talked before about the two infamous torture memos that John Yoo wrote or co-wrote. One was on August 1st, 2002, the other on March 14th, 2003. And in those two memos, John Yoo redefined torture far more narrowly than our law permits, saying that the person had to basically suffer something akin to organ failure in order to be tortured, and talking about how the president and how officials could get away with torture and not be charged under the War Crimes Act because they would be acting in self-defense or out of necessity, notwithstanding the absolute prohibition on torture, which I read earlier. Now, when after this August 1st, 2002 memo was public, the Department of Justice knew that it was indefensible. It was bad PR. So on June 1st, 2004, it was withdrawn. And on December 30th, 2004, the Department of Justice issued a new memo that that was supposed to supersede this August 1st, 2002 memo. And likewise, the March 14th, 2003 memo was also rescinded after it became public. One of the things that the March 14th, 2003 memo written by John Yoo said was that John Yoo said that the Department of Justice would not enforce U.S. laws against torture, assault, maiming, and stalking in the detention and interrogation of enemy combatants. Now, just in case people don't know what the maiming statute is that John Yoo didn't want to enforce, the maiming statute makes it a crime for someone with the intent to torture, maim, or disfigure, to cut, bite, or slit the nose, ear, or lip, or cut out or disable the tongue, or put out or destroy an eye, or cut off or disable a limb, or any member of another person, or throw or pour upon another person any scalding water, corrosive acid, or caustic substance. This is what John Yoo didn't want to enforce. In other words, if the CIA or someone acting for the U.S. government wanted to maim another person in under the guise of the so-called war on terror, we were not going to charge that person with maiming. John Yoo basically said that just because the statute says, that doesn't mean you have to do it, unquote. So we have here additional startling evidence in these newly released memos of a concerted plan by the Bush administration and their lawyers to basically suspend the Constitution if the president wanted to. Fourth Amendment, First Amendment, our treaties, that the president could unilaterally abrogate a treaty. The sky's the limit. There were almost no limitations.
All right, well, let me jump in here, Marjorie Cohen. Let me tell people you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We are speaking with Marjorie Cohen. She is president of the National Lawyers Guild and the author of the soon-to-be-released Rules of Disengagement, The Politics and Honor of Military Dissent. Now, let's sort of take this on the macro. John, you, by the way, obviously teaches, for those of you who don't understand this, we're broadcasting from Berkeley, and he's a stone's throw here from here at the University of California at Berkeley, the Bolt Law School, where he's teaching young students about the nature and the importance and the meaning of the Constitution. Now, back to this memorandum of October 23rd, 2001, and these other memorandums. I thought, and maybe you can consider these memorandums in the difference between what makes a democracy and what makes fascism.
Well, it's a good question. I mean, when you have a system of government that we do that has three separate co-equal branches of government, the legislative, the judicial, and the executive, to check and balance each other so that no one becomes more powerful, and no one understood more than the founding fathers the danger of the executive going hog wild, you have that kind of a government. And yet, then you have secret memos being written for the benefit of the executive branch to tell the executive that there are no checks on his power, that as long as he says we're in a war, he can do whatever he wants. He can suspend the Constitution. He doesn't have to go to Congress to make the rules about interrogation and detention and capture and trying people and abrogating treaties. He can do whatever he wants. And so then we're left with a single branch of government, and that's really what the Bush administration was doing for 8 years. We knew it was happening. We had seen some of the memos. There are some memos that we still haven't seen. For example, the same day that you wrote his August 1st, 2002 memo, that the horrible torture memo, the most infamous torture memo, there was an accompanying memo that approved the CIA's authority to use waterboarding. We haven't seen that. It hasn't been released. And it's my understanding that there are many memos that still have not been released. And my hope is that Eric Holder, the new Attorney General, I commend him for releasing these, that he will continue to release these memos so that we can understand what rules, if you want to call them rules, the Bush administration was operating under when they were spying on people without warrants, when they were torturing and abusing people, when they were rendering people to other countries where they were tortured, and the list goes on and on and on. And I do want to say one other thing. John Yoo is not at Berkeley this year. He is a visiting professor at Chapman Law School. I think he feels more comfortable
right,
at Chapman.
But they didn't fire him. He still's got, he still has his prestige.
He's just visiting.
He's visiting
in Orange County.
He left town, let's say.
Yeah, and
in
I
hurry.
Think he feels more comfortable in Orange County than he does in Berkeley for some reason.
All right, well, you also are charged with the great responsibility of training young people to be lawyers. You're a teacher of law at Thomas Jefferson down there in Southern California. By the way, there's no way to stop John Yoo, who has now advocated the overthrow of the Constitution and the use of torture, which was, by the way, we have to remember this stuff wasn't just written on paper. It was used, right?
Oh, yes.
This is an activist. These aren't just philosophy classes.
No, and in fact, the interrogations and detention of at least two men in waterboarding, Abu Zubaydah and Abd al-Ramin al-Nashiri, were also pursuant to these memos, and they were tortured. In fact, in my book, Cowboy Republic, I talk about what happened to Abu Zubaydah, and it was not a pretty picture, and Abu Zubaydah was not a top al-Qaeda leader. One of the FBI's leading experts on al-Qaeda, Dan Coleman, said that Abu Zubaydah knew very little about any operations, and yet Bush continued to say, I said Zubaydah was important. You're not going to let me lose face on this, are you, when George Tenet pushed back. But Zubaydah was tortured so badly that he confessed to al-Qaeda targeting the Brooklyn Bridge, the Statue of Liberty, shopping malls, banks, supermarkets, water systems, nuclear plants, apartment buildings. None of it was true. He was schizophrenic, and yet the Bush administration reacted zealously to every single report. So, I mean, you don't even have good intelligence coming out of these policies.
All right, we have a minute left, and the question I actually was getting to, as a teacher, as a professor, teacher of law, lover of the Constitution, your life devoted to the study of law, what's your response to the fact that this guy
is training young people to be? Are you concerned?
I am, in fact, Dennis. That's why the National Lawyers Guild called for not just the prosecution of John Yoo and the other lawyers for conspiring to break the law and with their shoddy legal reasoning, but also the investigation by the State Bar and his firing from Berkeley. This is not an issue of academic freedom. This is not an issue of him saying whatever he wants in his classroom or writing law review articles. This is an issue of a man who was paid by the president to advise the president on how to break the law and get away with it. And we're talking about war crimes. He's a war criminal, and he should be tried as a war criminal, and he should not retain his job at Berkeley because it's very dangerous. Number one, it's very dangerous that he is teaching our students these ideas that he has that are basically illegal. And number two, our taxpayer dollars are going to pay the salary of a war criminal, and that is just intolerable.
All right. Well, Marjorie Cohen, it is good to speak with you again, president of the National Lawyers Guild, and a book coming up, Rules of Disengagement, The Politics and Honor of Military Dissent. We will see what happens with John Yoo. Oh, I forgot to ask you, well, if he's guilty of these crimes, what about his boss?
Yes. Well, I have a new piece that's on my website, MarjorieCohn.com, that talks about that as well and why a special prosecutor should be appointed. And it's not just the lawyers, of course. It is also their bosses, and that is Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, John Ashcroft, George Tenet, who met in the
maybe
basement.
They could turn John Yoo state's witness. Maybe he'll cut a deal, cop a plea, and testify against his boss.
You know, that's a very interesting idea, especially since Michael Isikoff of Newsweek said on the Rachel Maddow show that there are emails between the White House and the lawyers, specifically John Yoo, Jay Bybee, and Stephen Bradbury. And if those could be the smoking guns, those could show that the Bush administration was basically telling them that they wanted the legal cover to break the law. And if that's the case, that's the smoking gun. But Dick Cheney admitted waterboarding. He's proud of it. And waterboarding's torture, as we know, torture's a war crime. George Bush said, "I knew they were meeting and doing this, and I approved." John Yoo wrote in the Wall Street Journal the end of January 29th, that Bush could waterboard. He could authorize waterboarding, and he did that three times. And so there are a lot of admissions in my book, Cowboy Republic, Six Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law. I actually make the case for charging these people with war crimes, and many other people have done that as well.
Well, we'll see. Maybe Mr. Yoo will see the better interests of the country, and maybe it'll help him keep out of jail. Thanks for being with us, Marjorie Cohn, and it's always informative to speak with you.
My pleasure, Dennis.
Time. Bye-bye.
Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Hillary Clinton arrived in Jerusalem last night as part of her first tour in her capacity as Secretary of State with the Obama administration. Clinton met with Israeli officials today, including Prime Minister-designate Benjamin Netanyahu, Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni, and President Shimon Peres. According to the Israeli daily Haaretz, Clinton stressed the U.S.'s, quote, unrelenting commitment. There's no doubt that any nation, including Israel, cannot stand idly by while its territory and people are subjected to rocket attacks. She made no mention, however, of the hundreds of tons of U.S.-made weaponry, including dime bombs, Hellfire missiles, and white phosphorus, that killed over 1,300 Palestinians inside the occupied Gaza Strip in December and January. Clinton arrived in Jerusalem after making an appearance at the so-called donor conference in Sharm el-Sheikh rebuilding of Gaza after the Israeli-U.S. siege. The Obama administration publicly announced that it will contribute $900 million, but as our next guest points out, $200 million of that money will go to cover deficits of the administration of Fatah, Quisling PA President Mahmoud Abbas, $400 million will be sent to boost West Bank projects directly tied to Israeli profit-making, and the remaining $300 million is set to be slated for Gaza, but may never get there because the United States refuses to associate with the elected Hamas party, the de facto government that is in charge of infrastructure across Gaza Strip. In the aftermath of the 22-day massacre by Israeli occupation forces in the Gaza Strip, Palestinians are still struggling to find adequate shelter, food, and medicine, and Israeli warplanes continue to bomb the southern border. Six Palestinians were injured in the latest airstrikes earlier today. Meanwhile, the Israeli Ministry of Construction and Housing says it has plans to construct at least 73,000 housing units in the occupied West Bank, an expansion of illegal settlement colonies that will double the amount of Israeli settlers inside Palestinian land. The Israel-based Peace Now human rights organization said in a statement yesterday, quote, "The completion of these projects will make the plan of creating a Palestinian state next to Israel totally unrealistic." Joining us to talk about this is Dr. Mazen Kumsia. Kumsia is a professor at Bethlehem University in the occupied West Bank. He is now president of the Palestinian Center for Rapprochement Between People and published several books, of which the most acclaimed is Sharing the Land of Canaan, Human Rights and the Israeli-Palestinian Struggle, and is a regular lecturer on issues of human rights and international law. Dr. Mazen Kumsia, you speak to us now from Bethlehem. It's good to have you with us today on Flashpoints.
Thank you for having me on your program.
So let's begin by talking about Hillary Clinton's visit today, her meetings with Benjamin Netanyahu, Livni, and Peres, and other Israeli officials. Apparently, Netanyahu, who has expressed time and time again that he is in favor of ethnic transfer of indigenous Palestinians out of Palestine, said that he has found common ground with Clinton. What are your thoughts on her visit to the region today, and what was left out of her schedule? You know, of course, she made the prerequisite visit to the Yad Vashem Nazi Holocaust Memorial Museum, but she didn't go to Gaza as was planned. What can you say about her arrival in Jerusalem today?
Her appearance was not really the kind of change that we had expected from the Bush administration to the Obama administration. The rhetoric and the language that she used were almost identical, word by word, for things like what George Bush and his previous Secretary of State used to articulate, a vision that's based on consolidating Israeli power and hegemony in the region, and a vision that's very narrow and that clearly have led to nowhere in the past few decades, basically, other than increased colonization and increased land confiscation in Palestine. I was very shocked by the language that she used in some of her public statements in front of the press and so forth. When she says that basically the U.S. Thinks that it is important to continue working towards a two-state solution, and that this attempt or work towards a two-state solution is in Israel's best interest. She didn't say that the two-state solution is in Israel's best interest, but that the working or the moving towards, I think the exact words she used is moving towards a two-state solution. But that's what we have been supposedly doing for the past two decades, is moving towards something that doesn't have any end in sight. And that's what I think is happening, is basically a consolidation of more rhetoric, more language, but no substance.
And also, Dr. Kumsia, there's a lot of talk about Israel's hardline threats against Iran and Iran's alleged nuclear capabilities. And of course, Israel is sitting on a secret nuclear weapons program itself and still doesn't allow the International Atomic Energy Agency inside to inspect anything. Yet Clinton meets with Israeli officials today, and Israel presents Clinton with a list of demands that it wants Washington to, quote, incorporate into its planned dialogue with Tehran about Iran's alleged nuclear program. Clinton, we all remember, said during her campaign for president last year that she wouldn't hesitate to, quote, obliterate Iran. What can you say about U.S.-Israeli policy on Iran and the region at this point?
The Israeli and American actions with regard to Iran are very much in line with previous attempts to contain any rising powers in the Middle East. This was the case with Iraq and the attempts to contain and eventually destroy and occupy Iraq, as has happened. And in the case of Iran now, the same forces, the same people who have pushed for the war in Iraq are pushing for a war in Iran. So basically we have the AIPAC and the right-wing Likudnik powers in the U.S. who have pushed for an invasion and occupying of a sovereign country contrary to international law and based on lies and distortions, things like the weapons of mass destruction and so forth. We see the same repeat of history happening with Iran. And I think this is going to be much more of a failure than the Iraq war was a failure. And I really think Obama has not really affected a change in this. And this is apparent by Clinton's rhetoric with regards to Iran.
That's the voice of Dr. Mazen Kumsia speaking to us from the occupied West Bank. Dr. Kumsia, let's talk a little bit about this donor conference. The Obama administration is pledging $900 million in so-called support for Gaza, but the breakdown of that money is falling along Israeli policy lines as expected, while at the same time the U.S. continues to pour billions, not just millions of dollars into the Israeli government. Can you talk about the breakdown of money allocations here and why many Palestinians and international human rights experts are viewing this as a complete distraction and a more empty posturing?
I mean, I live in the West Bank here, and we have more Palestinian security forces who have been trained by the Americans and basically handed weapons and so forth that the aid money that is supposed to come to the Palestinian people is being diverted to create basically a security force to solidify the occupation and solidify the actions of the of putting the Palestinians in Bantustans and concentration camps and having Palestinian police do the power of the military occupation of the Israeli occupation forces being replaced by Palestinian security forces. The U.S. wants to consolidate and enlarge this and expand it by strengthening the power of the Mahmoud Abbas government, which, by the way, his mandate expired on January 9th, and yet they consider him the president of the Palestinian Authority, and they want to give him billions of dollars in aid. And they say a small part of this, the number I heard is 300 million, is going to go to the Gaza Strip, 300 out of 900 million. Now, this 300 million, of course, is not going to be spent in Gaza in the places that is needed, like infrastructure and other areas that were damaged by Israel, including housing. But it's going to, and this is the words of Hillary Clinton herself, is going to strengthen the authority of the Palestinian Authority. In other words, this is to strengthen the groups in the West Bank that they consider more closely allied with the U.S. than the Hamas government. I am no fan of Hamas myself, but I also think that it is wrong to be doing these things to basically strengthen the division between Palestinian groups and to use money, basically, that is supposed to go for aid, to use it as a political weapon to guide the movement of Palestinians who are desperate for money in a direction that's more acceptable to the U.S. and to Israel.
Well, and we know that for at least the past few years, the United States has been very active in fomenting the divisions between Fatah and Hamas while propping up Fatah and people such as Mahmoud Abbas and Dahlan. And now we're seeing also in the West Bank, some of this money is supposed to go to West Bank businesses or schemes that will actually make profit for Israeli businesses. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I mean, this is a classic colonization tactic, which is to utilize the cheap labor of Palestinians and yet profit the occupation. So there will be industrial zones that have been established in the West Bank at the borders, at the seam zones between the areas that are those smaller and shrinking ghettos that are allocated to us. Palestinians, and to the larger, of course, State of Israel and the more, if you want, gentrified areas and areas that have been cleansed of the Palestinians. At the borders, there will be industrial zones. There's already some of them functioning, and more will be built that are supposed to improve the economy And that is actually what Netanyahu is pushing for, is an economic peace, what he calls. What I call it is economic exploitation and entrenching of the occupation. And this is going to be funded by American taxpayers, like everything else that happens here in terms of land confiscation, in terms of the ethnic cleansing that's ongoing, and the destruction of Palestinian lives and livelihoods.
And Dr. Mazen Kamsia, speaking more about this and the ethnic cleansing program and the colonization efforts, we just heard about 73,000 additional colony units inside and expanding from entrenched Israeli settlement colonies inside the occupied West Bank on Palestinian land that are due to be slated for construction. This is against, of course, international law, the roadmap, the 2007 Annapolis summit, whatever was accomplished or not accomplished in any of those, you know, et cetera. What's the significance of Israel's pledge to steal more land in the occupied West Bank at the same time as Hillary Clinton arrives to essentially bolster peace talks and the U.S.'s commitment to a so-called two-state solution? Can you talk about the significance of the timing?
I think it seems to be a pattern that every time there is a visiting dignitary from abroad or some movement towards continuing some form of negotiations, Israel releases or leaks or implements some form of action that shows that it intends to continue and indeed proceeds to continue its colonization practices. My take on this is that this is a deliberate process to basically show, number one, the Palestinians, and number two, the Israeli public, that the Israeli government is really moving in the direction that Zionism has set for a course 60 years ago when the State of Israel was established. The process of concentrating more Palestinians into smaller and smaller areas while taking their lands, their agricultural lands, their best lands, their water resources, and so on, and moving them into smaller and smaller shrinking areas or outright expulsion outside the country. This is happening not just in the West Bank, as we know, is also happening even inside the Green Line, inside the State of Israel itself. In the Negev, for example, there are villages that are being completely ethnically cleansed, and the villagers are moved into new locations, into other Palestinian villages inside the State of Israel, being increasingly surrounded by settlements and lands being taken from them. It's a way to impoverish the Palestinians, to decrease their ability to have a sustainable living here, and basically encourage as much migration or emigration outside the country as possible. It's an up-in-your-eye kind of, you know, in-your-face kind of attitude of increasing pressure and showing that we are the boss here and we can do whatever we want. And in fact, we can, while Hillary Clinton is here, announce another 73,000 new homes in the West Bank for Jewish settlers.
And Dr. Mazen Kamsia, this is the beginning of the annual Global Israeli Apartheid Awareness Week, and it comes on the heels of the bloody massacres in Gaza and the ramping up of extremely hardline racist Zionist policies against the indigenous Palestinians by Israeli officials and the government. What can you say about the importance of the emerging boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement at this time?
It is very critical. Our political options here in Palestine are becoming smaller and smaller, thanks to, of course, there's the surrounding countries being under U.S. Control, like Egypt and Jordan and so forth, that there's no background for ability to bring in supplies and support to the Palestinians, our increasing isolation and so on. We face a lot of difficulties. This venue of boycotts, divestment, and sanctions, the beauty and the power of it is that everybody can participate in it, both Palestinians and non-Palestinians, even Israelis and others who can help us in this regard. And we already saw this movement take off and grow logarithmically, actually, in the past few years. Now the Israeli Apartheid Week is in about 20 cities international and 20 cities here in Palestine where we have events. Even we had an event tonight in Beit Sahur here, where we did some action on the boycotts, divestments, and sanctions. So this is the kinds of things that I think will carry a lot of weight towards raising the world consciousness about what's going on here. The reason we choose the word apartheid, by the way, is because it's a legally binding definition of apartheid that was developed by the United Nations. It's not just an allusion to South Africa, but actually there's an international crime of apartheid that's applicable everywhere where apartheid happens, and Israel fulfills every single condition in this definition. So it is important that we follow the international legal definition, which is obligatory once people understand it. It's obligatory on us as civilian societies and as countries to engage in boycotts, divestments, and sanctions, or what we say for short, BDS.
And what are Palestinians doing there in the West Bank, inside Gaza, and in Jerusalem, and inside historic Palestine, Israel? And what's one thing people can do here in the belly of the beast in the United States to support the BDS campaign and get involved?
There's a huge amount of work that we can do. In fact, in the West Bank and Gaza, because we have essentially a captive market, Israel's second largest export after Europe is to the West Bank and Gaza. So we get a lot of Israeli products here which we can boycott. And internationally, we encourage people not only to engage in any boycott of any Israeli products, but also a boycott of Israeli academics, cultural institutions, and pressure their governments to apply sanctions on Israel, because an academic and cultural boycott is actually even more important than the economic boycott, in my humble opinion, because it allows Israel to finally face up to reality and face this way. When whites in South Africa were thinking of themselves as democratic and as part of Europe, while they were oppressing blacks and having apartheid in the system of the country, only when Europe and North America shunned white South Africans who are part of the system, only then did white South African elites begin to reflect and consider the possibility that they should live inside Africa and start facing the Africans and deal with the system, with changing the system of apartheid. And I think the same for Jewish Israelis. When they face a boycott, academic, cultural, every other way in Europe and North America, they will begin to reflect, and they will come back here and face Palestinians and try to correct some of the injustice that 60 years of ethnic cleansing has caused.
Okay, we're going to leave it right there. That's the voice of Dr. Mazen Kunsia. You're a professor at Bethlehem University in the occupied West Bank, and you also run the website kumsia.org. That's spelled Q-U-M-S-I-Y-E-H.org, where people can read some of your work and get linked up to many different campaigns you're involved in, including BDS campaigns. Dr. Mazen, thank you so much for all of your vital work, and we'll check back with you very soon.
Thank you very much.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.
Sunday Sunday, March 8th is International Women's Day, and KBOO is celebrating with a full day of music and special features. Tune in between 6 a.m. Sunday and 3 a.m. Monday for women in jazz, cowgirl music, oral histories, special interviews, and much more. KBOO is going to honor women's contributions and raise awareness of the issues that challenge us to action. Check out the full schedule online at kboo.fm. Join us Sunday, March 8th for International Women's Day on KBOO 90.7 FM.
This is KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, your community radio station. And at 11, it's the bike show at a new time. Today, celebrate amazing cyclists. Learn more about local bike heroes and the upcoming Alice B. Toklips Award ceremony that will honor their good work. They'll be taking call-ins after 11:20. Talk with your bike heroes at 503-231-8187. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from City Bikes, a worker-owned, cooperatively run, new and used bicycle sales and service shop with two locations on Southeast Ankeny near KBOO. Open 7 days a week for your bicycle commuting needs and online at citybikes.coop, citybikes.coop. The revolution is coming. Is your bicycle ready?
Good morning. You're listening to the KBOO Bike Show here on KBOO in Portland. We're on at our new time. We're now on the first Wednesday of every month at 11 o'clock in the morning, going from 11 o'clock until noon. We want to thank all of the KBOO Bike Show fans and listeners out there that rallied around us as we worked towards this new time. KBOO's got all sorts of great, exciting programming changes and getting different programs on at different times and really making sure that the programming that we offer here at the station is always relevant and meets the needs of our listeners. So as we worked through that process, we looked into some new times for the KBOO Bike Show, and we're really excited to be on from 11 to noon on the first Wednesday of every month. You can also always catch our podcast online at bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. Special thanks to Portland Transport for hosting our podcast. So again, thanks to everyone who rallied around and helped make it possible for us to get this great time slot for the program. We're on the air the first Wednesday of every month. This morning we're going to be talking with people who are being honored for their work as cyclists here in the community. The Alice B. Toklips Awards is coming up. This is the Bicycle Transportation's annual awards dinner, a great gala affair. It's amazing how large this event has grown to become. A huge room with hundreds of cyclists and fans out there. And every year, people are nominated for their work throughout Oregon, making this a better place to ride bikes. There are about 34 people nominated this year, and we've decided to jam-pack the KBOO studios with some really amazing people who have done great work in the community. So throughout the program, we're going to be talking with them, what keeps them going, why do they do what they do, and giving you a taste of some of the great work that these people have contributed to the bike community here in Oregon.
Good morning, Aileen. It's great to be here. And I'd love to introduce our guests this morning. Today we've got Robert Guti. He's the CEO and president of the ODS Companies, the highest ranking executive officer in Portland, commuting to work by bike, which is pretty amazing. He has also made it possible for thousands of workers across the state of Oregon to choose to commute by bike as well, and we are very glad to have him here. We've got Brad Ross, director of the Cross Crusade series, which has become an explosion of bicycle fun and entertainment and challenge every fall, in which we've got thousands, once again, of people across Oregon participating in. Mark Ginsberg, the perennial Alice nominee, will be joining us a little later in the show. Mark's been the Susan Lucci of the Alice Awards. He has been nominated almost every year that they've existed, and yet has not won. We're really gunning for him this year. And Judge Chris Larson and Mike Morrison, RN, who created the Share the Road class, which if any of you have ever had the unfortunate incident of getting yourself a ticket on a bike, this is a class you can take to help alleviate some of those fines from your burden, and in the meantime learn a lot about bike safety and a better way to ride on the road and make the entire community safer. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
So we'd love to start off, and I think I'm going to start off with Chris and Mike here, and find out let's talk a little bit about that Share the Road class. Can you describe a little bit about why you started it and what it is?
Well, it started as an effort from Chris coming to Emmanuel Hospital and saying, hey, you guys have been doing classes for motorists, and I've got some non-motorists that I want to refer to classes, and so let's get something going. So Chris initiated it by asking the Trauma Nurse Talk Tough program at the hospital to offer some classes that might be relevant to non-motorists as well. So it was Chris, as a bicycle enthusiast, that got that going.
And what kind of work did it take to actually get that involved? Because it is a city mandated program, or is it, who supports that?
Well, it didn't take me long when I was on the bench and hearing people that were appearing before me for a traffic violation trial, and this was about 5 years ago. It didn't take me long to realize that a lot of people didn't know what the law was or how to apply the traffic laws, and there was nothing for me as a judge to use to refer people to that rode bikes or have been cited as pedestrians. So actually the class idea was my idea, but it took a whole lot of collaboration with the Legacy Emmanuel Trauma Nurses Talk Tough program, which had been going on for a decade. So I took their model and then went to the Portland Police Traffic Division and got them on board, worked with the BTA, the Portland Department of Transportation, and then eventually the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition to create the class. So the Share the Road Safety class at Legacy Emmanuel is the first class that I know of its kind in the nation that is a alternative traffic safety and education class that bicyclists and pedestrians have access to. There's a whole lot out there for motor vehicle users, but there was nothing for bicyclists and pedestrians. So we created something out of nothing, essentially.
And what type of information do you cover in the class? How does your class differ from what someone might go through for just a regular vehicle infraction?
Our class is specifically geared to explaining the law that applies to motor vehicle users as well as bicyclists and pedestrians. So it is not weighted traditionally like other traffic safety classes for motor vehicle drivers. So anytime there's any interaction between a bicyclist, pedestrian, motor vehicle, it could even be a skateboarder, we cover that broad range of traffic law that you're not going to get in a traditional, driver safety class. And we do everything from, the law that requires motor vehicles to yield to bicyclists and bicycle lanes to the stop and stay stop law that requires all vehicles to yield to pedestrians that have entered the crosswalks to the more traditional stuff, just talking about how to obey yellow and red lights and stop signs.
And from a medical standpoint, we're a trauma center and we're trying to motivate people to change behavior to get them to take safety and the safety of others very seriously. And so our effort from the medical standpoint is trying to motivate a change of behavior and acceptance of the rules to do that.
So what do the people involved in the class think? Have you gotten good response from them? Does it seem like it's working and people are getting a lot out of it?
We have a very good response rate. After each class, we get evaluations from the classes, and 98% of them are favorable in terms of continuing the class. Over 90% agree that it's beneficial and has provided some information that they didn't have before. The participants in the class really appreciate the opportunity to not only talk to the judge, but talk to the police officers and find out and clarify what the laws are. Most of us haven't picked up a driver's manual since the age of 16 when we had to take a test on it. And obviously the laws change on a biannual basis when the legislature meets.
It seems also like for people who are walking and biking, it's hard to think about how those laws relate to them, because we go through driver's education, but we don't go through other education for how to interact on the road. And I often think about this with cyclists. When I see cyclists doing ridiculous things on the road, I think, you know, well, they're just trying to figure out what's going to work best and what's most comfortable. And sometimes they get it wrong because they're flustered, or sometimes they're just not paying attention. But there really isn't a lot of great education out there for how to navigate the roads outside of a car. So it sounds like your class, unfortunately, the way they wind up there is not the most positive. But it sounds like it could be a great educational tool moving forward and, you know, helping those people out.
Well, a lot of people appreciate not only the break on the citation and the break on the fine, but they also appreciate that they've learned something, that there is some tips that they've gotten from the class that they hadn't thought about before. And one of the real advantages of it is just bringing commuters together, whether they're bicycle, pedestrian, or bicyclers, or car drivers, and realizing that we're all in this together. We all walk. Most of us have ridden a bike at some time, and the majority of bike riders also drive cars.
That sounds great. It sounds like you guys have put together an incredible program. And if people get an infraction, how do they sign up for your class? Do they request it, or is the information available to them?
Well, the officer at the time they're decided to issue a citation, let's say to a motor vehicle driver, a bicyclist, or a pedestrian, they're able to give folks a small little yellow referral slip that gives them instructions on how to register for the course at Legacy Emmanuel Hospital. It's $30. It's offered twice a month, the second and fourth Wednesday night of each month. And then the individual that's cited and referred actually contacts Legacy Emmanuel, signs up for the class. They take the class. At the end of the two-hour class, they get a certificate. They file it with the court. And then it's the officer that has agreed essentially to either dismiss the particular violation, which means no conviction, or enter a sentence of, or recommend that the judge enter a sentence of discharge, which means you escape the mandatory minimum fines that we have for most traffic violations. So it's a referral through the officer. The folks can also get referred through court staff, and quite frankly, just through word of mouth. Everybody that is cited for an eligible violation is able to take the class once and once only. So it doesn't matter if you've got a driving record that is poor. If you've never taken the Share the Road Safety class before, then you're automatically eligible to take it for only a particular set of eligible violations. And this is something that was agreed to by all of the law enforcement agencies that cite people into court for traffic violations. So we got law enforcement on board, and then of course the class is taught by myself as a judge, Mike Morrison as a trauma nurse, an officer teaches, a representative from the Bicycle Transportation Alliance teaches, and we also have we've had participation from Portland Department of Transportation and Willamette Pedestrian Coalition. So it's really a broad-based group that instructs, and we cover a lot of laws that hopefully apply to all road users, not just motor vehicle users.
And as in this room, you get four or five people that are all wanting to talk within the same time. It's hard to get it done in 2 hours.
So you guys are, your program is of 34 nominees for the Alice B. Toklips Awards this weekend. Are you guys going to be in attendance this weekend?
We'll be there, sitting with Mr. Ginsburg.
Well, if they let me out of Emmanuel Hospital a little early on this weekend, I'll plan on being there.
Well, we will be there as well, cheering you guys on. So we hope that you guys are able to win the coveted Toklips Award. Thank you so much for joining us on the program this morning. We're going to let you guys scoot out and move on to the rest of our jam-packed audience here. But thanks so much for joining us. That's Mike Morrison and Judge Chris Larson there with the Share the Road safety class. Thanks for all the great work that you guys do in the community.
Thank you very much. It's nice to just been nominated. It's a great crowd to be with. Thank you.
Thank you. And this morning we've also got Robert Guti here. He's the CEO of the ODS Companies, and he is an avid bike commuter, and he's opening up the opportunity to commute by bike to many people across the state of Oregon, not just in Portland. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning.
It's great to have you here today. How did you start cycling? Have you always been a cyclist, or is this a newer thing for you?
Well, it's a newer thing as an adult, let's say. I started about 7 or 8 years ago. Started with my commute from East Moreland opened up because they opened up the Springwater Trail between Oaks Park and OMSI, so it made it very easy. It's, you know, what has to be one of the most wonderful commutes in the United States to go along that trail and, you know, stay out of traffic and see the osprey and the geese and everything else. It's just a wonderful experience. So that's how I started. And we as a corporation had begun about the same time a sponsorship of Cycle Oregon. So wanting to be involved in that, I thought, you know, I'd better walk the walk, so to speak, and not just talk the talk. And so I've been on Cycle Oregon several years, and you had to do some training for that. And for me, I don't have the time because of my schedule to do long training trips, and so I do this little 5 or 6 mile one-way commute from East Moreland going and coming each day. So that's how I got started.
And you obviously have a lot of important decisions to make given your role in the company. Do you feel that being a bike commuter gives you a different perspective when you're dealing with stressful situations or you have a lot on your mind? Do you think that your commute to work being by bike and, again, seeing Osprey and being along that gorgeous route, does that affect the decisions you have to make or give you a different peace of mind for those decisions?
I think it's the latter. I had a very I rode my bike in today, and I was thinking about it. There's a great peacefulness about it. And even though you have to be aware, you have to pay attention, but certainly on the Springwater Trail you can relax a little bit. And I do a lot of my daily planning there. I think about some of the most important things I want to accomplish. And it's interesting that when I go through that mental process, things seem much more hopeful when I'm on my mm-hmm. bike. And I don't worry about, you know, gee, what the stock market did this week or this month and what unemployment is doing. And, you know, the kinds of problems seem much more solvable. And so it's a very hopeful kind of thing. I actually enjoy it a great deal. And at the same time, at the end of the day, I have that same relaxation on the other end, and it's a great way to end the day for me.
So do other people within your company, have you been able to inspire other people to get on their bikes and ride to work?
Well, I think so. It's not something I keep track of. There are a lot of commuters at ODS. We have about 1,200 employees, and we have them in Bend and in LaGrande and, of course, here and in Milwaukee, here in Portland's Milwaukee. And there are bike facilities in each location and each building, and we've built them into that. And that makes it a lot easier. So we certainly encourage them in that regard. And we have our own, we're a health insurance company, of course, and so we have our own internal website, and I've promoted exercise and a healthy lifestyle, and I demonstrate that through how I do it, and biking is a key component of what it is that I do. So I would hope that being the CEO that there's a factor of acceptance in all of that. I think one of the inhibitions about commuting and becoming a biker is you kind of worry about, you know, what you're going to look like, and I certainly don't worry about that. You know, it's actually one of the things I look forward to. I'm sitting here in my suit and such, and that's not what I bike on. But I very much enjoy getting out of the CEO role and just being a bike commuter and being like everybody else out there that's doing it. And for me, that's also kind of an escape and a release.
And how do you feel about being nominated for this prestigious annual award?
Well, I think it's wonderful. I didn't know that you could be nominated more than once, so this is a first-time honor for me, and I didn't know that there were 34, and I think that that is indicative of the community here in Portland, of the biking community and the leadership. I was sitting listening to your other two guests talk about the Share the Road educational program, and I didn't know about that. It sounded great, and I'm a several year commuter, but I make a lot of mistakes on the bike. Sometimes you get out there and you don't, you get in, it's first of all, it's hard to hear things and you just kind of get into your own zone, and that can be not so good. And so I think understanding exactly what your responsibilities are, very good idea.
Along those lines, do you have any tips that you would offer for other new commuters, especially I think when people are in the type of work environment where they have to wear a suit, they have to be dressed up? I think that can sometimes initially seem like a barrier. So what are some tips that you would offer to somebody else who's looking to maybe shifting into doing more bike commuting to the workplace?
Well, it's easier than you think. You know, it's intimidating at first because you're trying to think of logistics. You know, first is clothing, and you have to have a bicycle, and you have to have a route, and all of those things are easier than you would think. And certainly in Portland, there are many other people that you can learn from. There are those that have friends, and I've done this. I've offered to show them the way, so to speak, how to get to the Springwater Trail from Selwood or from Eastmoreland, and how to get downtown across the Hawthorne Bridge and go where it is that they need to go. So finding someone else that's doing it is a big help. And then not worrying too much about, you know, you don't have to, I think everybody wants to look cool, you know, and wear the spandex and all that sort of stuff. And that's not what I do. I actually wear some clothes that I fish in. I have a jacket that I fish in cold weather that I wear. And in the summer, you know, there's a lot less, and I wear by layers, and I don't clip into the pedals. I just wear some regular Keen open face mesh shoes, and it's just I make it easy on myself. You know, I don't wear some of the same clothes that I jog in on the weekends or something like that. So you know, make it easy on yourself. Dress warm, dress in layers, dress so that you don't get wet. You know, if you get cold and wet, it's not going to be any fun. And have your commute lined out. If you can't do that, do it with someone else that's already doing it. And it'll be very easy. Once you get through it a couple – I can remember the first time that I commuted, I went in and my secretary was there, and I just looked. I said, I made it. You know, and I was so pleased with myself. I'm sure she wondered, you know, thought it was kind of weird. But it isn't that hard. And once I made it that first time, every other time was easy.
That's great. That's really great to hear.
So it's kind of more of a psychological barrier in some ways.
I think so.
Yeah.
Well, you, again, are one of the nominees for the Alice B. Toe Clips Awards this weekend. Will you be in attendance at the awards ceremony?
No, I'm not going to be. Unfortunately, in my role, and I as a CEO, we have board meetings. And we have one this weekend at the Coast, and it's our shareholder meeting and our annual meeting. And that's a tough one for the CEO to miss.
Yeah, so. That sounds like a pretty major obligation to duck out on.
Well, hopefully you will be one of the award recipients. We wish you the best
you.
Of luck. We know you have a busy schedule this morning, so we'll let you scoot out as well. But thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here, Robert. We've also got this morning Mark Ginsburg, who we have not heard from yet, and Brad Ross, director of the Cross Crusades. Good morning.
And we also have a caller on the line. We'll go to our first caller. Good morning, John. You are on the KBOO Bike Show.
Good morning. Hey, since you got the bicycle community on the air, hopefully, I'd like to put out an idea because I see some crazy, dangerous stuff. And the idea I want to put out is let's stay off of Southeast 39th Avenue.
Okay, John, thanks so much for your call this morning. We're actually talking about people who have been nominated for the Alice B. Toe Clips Awards. This is the annual celebration that the Bicycle Transportation puts together to honor cyclists statewide who are doing great work in the community. We don't have a lot of time on the program this morning. We have a lot of people to get to, so we're going to stay focused on these guests here. One thing we do want to make sure we mention is that though there are 34 people who have been nominated for this award, and that's a great number, there are many more people out there that we think are doing great work in the community. So we'd love to hear from you this morning. If you'd like to share with us your stories of people in the community who maybe they didn't make it on the nomination list, I know personally I just didn't get around to sending in that nomination, but I've got lots of people in mind. We'd love to hear from you this morning. Who would you like to see having been awarded or nominated, or of the people who are nominated, who are you rooting for? I know personally I'm rooting for everyone who's been in the studio with us this morning, especially Mark Ginsburg, who we'll talk with in a moment here, because he's been nominated every year. In fact, I nominated him 1 year, and he's doing great work. It's kind of funny at this point that you've never won for all these years. But so we'd love to hear from you at 503-231-8187. That's the number here at the KBOO Studios. If you'd like to share with us your stories of bikers in the Oregon area that you think should be on the list, maybe for next year for the Alice B. Toklips Award.
Or if you'd like to talk to our audience about someone who has been nominated and tell a little bit more about what they're doing, or if you have questions for our guests, please give us a call.
We could also offer tips for what to do when you do win, because you get this big fat award. Personally, mine's next to my front door, so everyone who comes in my house knows what kind of person they're dealing with, that we might have conversations about biking stuff. Sarah Stout, who's also one of the hosts of the KBOO Bike Show, received an award as a group award back in 2002 for Bike Summer 2002, and I just received an email from her today asking where the award should go next. It passes through the hands of multiple people who were involved in Bike Summer 2002. It's a nice tradition that every year it moves on to a new person's mantle or front doorstep. So it's nice to see that happening. Hopefully the rest of those of you in the room with us today will also go home with a big fat award.
So Brad, have you been involved with the Cross Crusade since its inception?
Mostly as a participant. I was when I first moved to Oregon, the Cross Crusade wasn't even called the Cross Crusade. It was just called, I don't know, the cyclocross, the thing we all did in the fall. And then I just did it as a participant. And then I just, I don't know, just sort of morphed into it over the years. I started helping the folks that were first putting it on. Then it was Jeff Hayes way, way, way back in the day, if anybody knows that name anymore. And then Rick Potestio and Russ Humberston. Took it over from him, and I started helping them out just to kind of get free race entry, and it sort of morphed into, it's obviously gotten to be a much bigger, bigger thing than it was in the 90s when I first moved here, and now it's my job.
And so, what's the growth been like in participation?
Well, other people have figured that out and told me it seems like it's like 20% a year, you know, I remember like 5 years ago, we had a race and there were like 350 people at the race. And we were like, yeah, woo, we 350 people came to a cross race. And now, if we have a race that is under 1,000, we're kind of bummed out. Like, what went wrong? What did we not get quite right, you know?
So. That's great. And also, I think a huge part of what I found part of the enjoyment of Cross Crusade is the spectator participation as well. It's not just an activity for someone who's racing, but it's for those it's the environment.
We do everything we can to make it super fun for the participants and for spectators. We try to make the races, as many of the races as possible, be real central in, it's a Portland series. People think of it as a statewide series, but really the Cross Crusade is a Portland series. So we do everything we can to have the races be easy to get to, and also fun for people to watch. The cool thing about cross is it's a super fun sport to watch. You can stand in one place and drink a beer and watch people watch the races going on. And usually I think the reason it's grown is simply because people come to a race and they watch one, and then they pretty much want to go out and do it because it just looks so fun, you know.
And what makes a cyclocross race a cyclocross race? What are the elements of the race that designate it as that?
Well, it's a sport that actually didn't even start as a sport. It was actually, the reason it started, first of all, not as a sport, was during World War I, when it was kind of before there was radio communications in Europe, and they used cyclists to go back and forth between the actual guys that were fighting on the front lines of the war, and then the generals and the people that were making the giving the orders, which were 3 or 4 or 5 miles back, and the cyclists had to just get there however possible. And so sometimes they had a road to ride on, sometimes they had to ride across a farmed field And sometimes they had to ride through the forest. And sometimes they had to get off the bike and run with their bike. And because they were the couriers that had the... And so after World War One, then people were like, well, that's kind of cool, you know. Well, let's do that in the fall. And that's kind of how it came out. So now really cyclocross is basically made up of three different things that you ride your bike across. You're on pavement sometimes, you're on grass sometimes, and you're on whatever else kind of terrain we can think of putting you on. And then also there are times when we actually put barriers out on the course that you actually have to get off your bike and carry your bike and run. So, and the course, and the laps are real short. They're, you know, traditionally we want the laps to be about 8 minutes long or something like that. So you're doing, you know, in a 45-minute race, you're doing like 6 or 7 laps around this course.
On a circuit.
On the circuit, yeah.
And it really is, I think, those barriers you have to jump over and the funny terrain that really makes it such a spectator sport.
Yeah.
You can see so many interesting things happening.
Yeah, it's a blast. And it's super fun to race in, too. And the thing that I think that the Cross Crusade, I have a feeling the reason I'm here is because we've done a really good job of making the Cross Crusade super inclusive for people of all ages, all sexes, and all ability levels. We average over 200 women at a Cross Crusade race. And many of those women are 50 years old or older, and not all of them are 6% body fat. You know, I mean, we've got all different types of people out racing their bikes. And so it's not kind of like what Robert from ODS there was saying, you know, it's a sport that you can get, I don't know how to say it. It's not really very threatening, mm-hmm. like road racing or mountain bike racing, where you feel like you have to have the right clothes and look right, and if you're not super skinny or whatever, you're going to get laughed at. You know, cyclocross, everybody laughs at everybody. You're all just going out and getting muddy and working up an excuse to drink beer. So, you know.
And I think I've been witness to people racing in everything from, you know, cut off shorts to full spandex kits to
costumes,
bikinis. It's men and women in bikinis.
or sometimes not even with bikinis.
Yes.
Right. This morning we're talking with nominees of the Alice B. Toklips Awards. Currently we're talking with Brad Ross, who is the organizer of the Cross Crusade series. We're going to take a moment to go to our phone lines and hear from some of our listeners. We've got Tiana on the line. Good morning. You are on the KBOO Bike Show.
Good morning. I've got a quick question about commuting around Portland on my bike. Am I in the right spot?
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm from Vancouver, and I go on the weekends to Portland with my 11-year-old daughter, and we jump on our bikes and try to explore town that way. And I just hit the market and, like, Powell's Bookstore or whatever, and I found ourselves riding on the sidewalk.
Would that be downtown Portland?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I'm just kind of wondering, is it appropriate to ride out in the streets, and kind of what would your advice be for exploring, you know, the Portland area on your bike with an 11-year-old, somewhat experienced bike rider?
Well, it's a little bit off topic, but I'm going to throw some suggestions out at you. First of all, riding downtown pretty much in Fairless Square, what is considered Fairless Square, it's against the law, actually, to ride on the sidewalks. You can be ticketed. That's something you want to avoid doing if possible. And so riding downtown with your daughter might not be the best place to start, unless possibly you are maybe on the park blocks. Those would be the quietest streets downtown. But the waterfront is great for it. Just kind of exploring both the Esplanade and Waterfront Park are great for some easy in-town trips. And the Esplanade actually turns into the Springwater Trail, and you can get out that way and kind of go down into Selwood, which is a little easier to ride on the streets down there, a little bit quieter traffic-wise, and you can go get some coffee or whatnot. As far as Portland, I would say stick to the east side and buy a Bike There map, which is available at all major bike shops and probably even bike shops in Vancouver. It's put out by Metro, and that will show you all the streets that are, it's coded by color to show you what streets are safe to ride on and what streets are to be avoided. And there's a thing called bike boulevards, which means low traffic, low volume streets with low speed limits that have limited stop signs, and those are probably the best places to ride in Portland. So I just kind of map out a destination for yourself and try it there. You can also contact the BTA for some advice as well. And the City of Portland actually has some programs. I would look at their transportation options department on the internet. And I know that there's a commuter consultation that the that River City is doing right now, and that might be a place to look into.
Okay, great. So is there, does Brad know of some beginning bike races around here that would be appropriate for me and my 11-year-old daughter, or is it just older people in general?
There's a series of races that happens at Portland International Raceway, which is actually really close to Vancouver. I think you could probably ride your bike there. And on Mondays, there's it's not going to start for a while. It pretty much just takes place in the summertime. But every Monday night at PIR, Portland International Raceway, people of all ages and ability levels can go out and give road racing a try. There's also, later in the summer, if you're interested in mountain bike racing, also on Monday nights, also at Portland International Raceway, is a series of races there called the I believe it's just called the
Short Track Series.
The Portland Short Track Series, which is a really introductory level mountain bike race.
Okay, well, thank you so much, and safe travels to everyone, and thanks for all your help.
And then, okay, well, I'll cut in one more thing. That the place to find out anything about bicycle racing is a website called OBRA.org, Oregon Bicycle Racing Association.org.
That's what I really needed to know, actually, so thank you.
Thanks so much for your call this morning. And we'll stay on our phone lines here with another call from our listeners. We've got Ann on the line. Good morning. You are on the KBOO Bike Show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question for the cross guy.
Go right ahead.
Well, my friends and I are avid bicycle riders, and we all don't have cars. We are also don't have much income, and usually cross races are about $20, and I really wanted to ride cross, but having to pay $20 every time to enter a race, it's, if you make minimum wage and you're a student, it's not very doable, and I'm wondering if some sort of student discount or something would be something cross people would think about.
Sure. I don't know. I what we have batted around the idea of doing was having, I don't know, what we've thought about doing was giving a discount to people that actually ride their bikes to the venue. Sometimes it's easy to do, sometimes it's not. In fact, some of our races that we're going to be holding here in 2009, you'll be able to take the max to. So I think that we are probably going to implement some sort of a discount for people that don't drive their cars to the races. I don't know how much that will be, maybe $5 off or something. I think we charge $22 for a cross race. So it's definitely something that we think about. Other races are really expensive to put on, so we do need, it costs probably $12. It costs me $12 for every participant to, enter a race, and so we do need some money. But at the same time, there are grants we could do. I don't know. We haven't send in some ideas. I'm all ears.
And you can send that into crosscrusade.com.
Sure. Yeah, we have a forum page on our website, which is crosscrusade.com, and you can enter onto that forum page and write anything you want to write, and I read everything.
Thanks for calling, Ann.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
And we're going to go to one more caller here before we get into talking. We still want to talk more about the party, and we want to talk with Mark, and we want to continue talking
Mark
with Brad.
Mark is a party professional, considering he's attended many times.
He's a really good partier, actually.
Mark and I both have been nominated. I think I've been nominated also at least probably 8 times. And so, yeah, we're the two like multi-nominees that have never actually won.
We have the right people in the studio.
Yeah, exactly. But before we get to continuing our conversation, let's go to the phone lines for one last call here. We've got Shane on the line. Good morning, Shane. You are on the KBOO Bike Show.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to...
Please hang up.
I'm sorry. You can go ahead. Shane, are you there? Oh, it looks like we may have lost Shane, but maybe he'll call back. So in the meantime, we want to move on. We've got Mark Ginsburg in the studio with us. Mark Ginsburg is a lawyer that specializes in bicycle law. He's also been on the Bicycle Advisory Committee. He's done extensive work back in the day to work with critical mass from a legal standpoint and working on relations between critical mass and the way it interacts in the city and with the city of Portland and the police bureau. He's been involved in the Community Cycling Center in the very early days and also a lot of great work with the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. I'm sure there are additional projects that I'm leaving out of the mix there, but you have quite an extensive repertoire, so it's great to have you in the show this morning.
I'm glad to be back. Thanks, Rob. Me.
So, yeah, how many times have you been nominated?
A lot. I stopped counting. I mean, as some other folks have said before, it's great to be nominated, but at the same time, the work that I do is work that I love, so I'm going to keep doing it no matter what. And it's just fabulous stuff to be able to do.
And you do a wide variety of different projects related to cycling. What is it about the work that you do that keeps you going?
Well, I'm a bicyclist, and I'm a strongly opinionated guy, and I happen to go to law school. And so those always sort of fit together perfectly for who I was. Even before I was in law school, I was doing bicycle advocacy. And so then I had the opportunity to go to school and learn this entire additional group of tools. And then to take those and apply them to advocacy that I was already doing, I think hopefully raised my game a little bit.
So did you start, you're right now practicing kind of bicycle-focused law, but is that where you started? Is that where your original practice was?
Yes and no. I when I first got out of law school, I worked for some other firms and had some opportunities to really learn a lot from very experienced lawyers, but it was always sort of there simmering in the background. When I first came to Portland for law school, I immediately joined this, you know, 300-500 member organization called the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. And, you know, they had a couple staff members. They were pretty small at that point. And just to watch them grow has been great. And then through all of the various jobs that I've had as an attorney, I've always been able to help bicyclists either formally in my day job or, you know, I did serve 2 terms on the VTA's board of directors. I was their vice chair for a while. And just always been able to do that either in my job or outside of my day job as well.
We have Shane back on the line, so we'll go to our phone lines for a moment. Shane, you are on the KBOO Bike Show.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to make a call out to the parent who called in earlier and looking for some good rides with her kids, and wanted to mention Kidical Mass.
Of course.
Which is a great ride for families and people just getting comfortable riding. And I know that up in Portland, there tends to be 2 or 4 rides going on every month. And they can get more information at kidicalmass.org.
Great. Thanks so much for your call this morning. So the party, that this little party that's coming up on Saturday, I am assuming you two fine gentlemen have been to the party before?
A couple of times. How many tables have we shared?
I think we've shared a couple tables through the years, certainly.
What? How many times have we attempted to get kicked out and haven't?
We haven't been able to get thrown out yet, but we'll keep trying. This might be our lucky year. We'll either win or get thrown out. It's one or the other.
I heard that there are some people out there who are trying to up the ante at the award ceremony, because award ceremonies being what they are, and there are people up there speaking and everyone's dressed up, they could be dry, but I hear that there are people who are trying to bring it up to a higher level this year. And by higher level, I mean more fun. So it could be interesting.
You know, every year that I go, I think one of the things that energizes me about the awards is to see all these people doing great advocacy work and fun work, and it really energizes me. You know, Brad and I are friends. We know each other outside of the awards, but there are all these other people who I get to see, who I don't see very often, and, oh, that person, they do that great work, and it really just shows you the possibilities. Because one of the things that I think is very important about any kind of advocacy work is that you've got to like the work you're doing. I mean, that's what gives you the drive. Is if it's something you don't care about, you're not as motivated. And to see all these people doing, you know, the flavor of bicycle issues that they care about is really just incredible to see. The diversity is amazing.
The thing that I want to say about that is it's great. I've seen in the last couple of years that the Bicycle Transportation Alliance and the Oregon Bicycle Racing Association have really started to come together and work together. It seems in the past there has been this sort of unsaid
thing that, you know, racers are racers and commuters are commuters, and they're kind of from a different mold. And what we really realized that is racers really are commuters. You know, I mean, I race my bike, but I also ride my bike to the grocery store and commute and things like that. And at the same time, commuters might not think they're racers, but I can't tell you how many times I've been going up Hawthorne at 5 o'clock in the afternoon and gotten into a full-on commuter race.
The Hawthorne crit.
Yeah, they love to race each other. So we're really, you know, we're the same people. We're all the same people, you know. And so I think that's great. And I think that it's great that those two organizations are starting to share ideas and work together.
Well, and I would say for myself, from my own experience, I never thought I would race a bike ever. As a matter of fact, the first time due to cyclocross that I had to be seen in public in spandex, I actually cried because it was on Mount Tabor. And I shed a tear. But the cross, what's beautiful about the Cross Crusade is for someone like me that was very intimidated, it bridged that gap from commuter to racer. And now I have a much more fit lifestyle because I like to go ride my bike for fitness now and have integrated that into part of my life too, which I never thought was going to happen. So,
yeah, I would agree that I think Cross Crusades, we owe a lot of thanks to the races for bridging those communities because there are spectators at the races who are in a lot of cases commuters, and there are, you know, it's relaxing the formal structure of races. To me, races used to seem so off limits because I didn't know the jargon and it just wasn't my thing. But if I can go and watch, that makes me feel more connected to it. And so I think the lines that there was that really hard line in the past, and I feel like those lines are blurred now and everyone's just working together, which is exactly what we need in the bicycle community.
Yeah, I think beer, Belgian waffles, and French fries can really bring us together in ways, as well as bike racing, that we never thought possible.
And I also think Brad and the Cross Crusade guys deserve a lot of credit for expanding the categories of racers. Mm-hmm. You know, 10 years ago, cyclocross in Portland, there were maybe 2, 3, 4 categories. Now, Brad, what is it, 10 categories or so?
Yeah, I don't have it in front of me, but I think we have 8 different women's categories. So
wow.
We have a Masters 50-plus mm-hmm. women's category, and we get over 30 women that participate in that mm-hmm. category alone. And then, you know, the juniors categories. So, yeah, there's a category and a race for everybody. We have a Clydesdales race, which unfortunately I now qualify for.
And what is the Clydesdales race?
200 pounds plus.
I never would have guessed that, Brad.
The women now want to have an Athena category. That might be our new category
Ooh.
Next year, the Athenas,
uh-huh.
which isn't 200 pounds, but it's approaching it. I'm not sure what
Well, and also to the caller that called in earlier and said, you know, how can I get how can I participate with my family? There's also Kitty Cross. There's,
yep.
there's Kids Cross and Junior Cross as well. So really, from as little as they are to be able to be on two wheels to retired AARP, it doesn't matter. Everyone can participate.
Yeah, my little four-year-old boy, Brett, he's a seasoned cyclocross veteran now.
We want to recognize that there are a lot of other great people doing work in the community, but if you guys had to pick a couple, who are some of the people doing other work in the community that may or may not have been nominated for the Alice B. Toklips Awards that you guys would like to give a shout out to?
Well, for me in the racing community, there's one man and one family that says it all. I mean, obviously there are many people like Candy Murray, who's won a Alice Toklips Award, and many people in the racing community that make that really make it happen. But the person that I really want to recognize is Carl Cadenaugh. He and his family own Alpenrose Dairy, and they are the ones that built the velodrome just for the fun of it, not because they needed to. They don't charge anybody to go there. They also host the first Cross Crusade race of the year, and they don't, here again, they just do it for the fun of it, you know, and they've got all these different sporting venues out there on the dairy, and they don't charge anybody for any of that. They just do it because they think it's cool. So I would nominate Carl Cadenaugh Jr. and the whole Cadenaugh family at Alpenrose Dairy.
That would be actually pretty amazing. Maybe next year. Maybe 2010.
I think maybe Brad and I will write that nomination together. The Cadenaugh family boys have been very supportive of cycling and all its flavors. I think the other maybe category of people, I would say, rather than a person, there's always a ton of great people, is the commuter who drags their friend along. You know, I think, and especially with it's almost springtime, it's sunny today, You know, summer is the time to encourage a friend of yours to commute. And I also think there's this emphasis. I think people are intimidated a little bit that they're either a bicycle commuter or they're not. And I think that's too much. I mean, if you could say to someone, what if you could reduce your fuel consumption by 20%? They'd say, well, what do I do? What product do I buy? You know, leave your car at home one day. Bike to work on Fridays in the summer. So think about the friend of yours that's on the fence and invite them to commute with you on a Friday this summer.
Well, and I think what's special also about the Alice Awards is someone like Robert Guti, who I hadn't met before this show, and I wouldn't have known all the things he did to kind of that would be, I guess, his category to a certain extent. He's got hundreds and thousands of friends apparently out there that he's encouraging to get on bikes, which is pretty fabulous.
So as veterans in the bicycle community and of the awards ceremony, what do you guys see as being the current state of affairs for cycling in Oregon? Are things getting better? What kinds of things should we be doing to make it better? What's it like out there in your viewpoint?
Well, I think one of the places where there's always going to be more work is getting everybody to get along. And there are always going to be some bicyclists who don't obey the law. And there are always going to be some car drivers who don't, but I think we need to always bear in mind the vast majority are in the middle. And, you know, we see a lot of hype in the media when there's sort of a one-off event because, you know, thousands of commuters biked to work today is not as big of a headline as one bicyclist and one car driver got into a conflict. And so I think, you know, we can always do better advocacy to recognize that everybody wants to use the road safely and together. You know, in my work as an attorney, I see a lot of car versus bicycle crashes, and very, very infrequently are those intentional. You know, they're accidents, they're collisions. They may have happened from someone's negligence in the technical sense, but I think we need to keep creating the spaces for us to get along. Portland is looking at doing its first cycle track. A couple people have advocated, I think this is a really good way of putting it, for creating a bicycle environment for the 8 to 80 crowd. Because it's not the 30-year-old or the 20-year-old or even the 40-year-old who feels comfortable riding, but it's the little kids, like the first caller asking about where to ride with my 11-year-old daughter, or the 60-year-old or the 70-year-old who's retired and just wants to go for a ride. And those are the bicyclists who can feel intimidated by riding in automobile traffic. And so we need to look at how we can make planning decisions to make our cities comfortable for those people to ride their bicycles so they don't feel that they must get in their car to get around.
So part of the work that we've done to get to where we are in the bike community is there have been a lot of different projects over the years. There have been different movements and rallies and groups and clubs that have made Portland what it is and Oregon what it is today. A real instrumental force in all of that at a certain time was Critical Mass, and I know, Mark, you were quite involved in all that. What are some of your memories from that time, and where do you see that leaving us now?
Well, I think I wish Critical Mass was still active in Portland, but for whatever the myriad of reasons, people don't show up anymore. And Critical Mass certainly had a lot of waves of growing pains. There were times when the relationship between the Critical Mass riders and the police were terrible. And within the first block of the group leaving, you would see the first tickets. And then through the work of a lot of people, including Sarah Stout and Fred Nemo and other folks who we've talked about and not, there were, and this is going back over 15 years at this point, a series of sit-downs with the police that sort of would go in waves. There'd be sit-downs for a while, and then there wouldn't be, and then there would, and then there wouldn't be. And I really think that opened a lot of doors, including some of the relationships we see now. The Portland police now have a bicycle liaison officer, Officer Robert Pickett, who's also been nominated for a BATA Alice Award, who's also currently the vice chair of the Portland Bicycle Advisory Committee. At the Portland Bicycle Advisory Committee, we now see the Portland Police Bureau traffic captain attending those monthly meetings. And I think those things are the sort of outflow of what started happening 15 years ago and the relationships that got established. Even maybe 3 or 4 years ago, the Zoo Bombers and Portland Police Bureau's central precinct weren't getting along very well. But knowing the history of the police and Critical Mass sitting down and talking in Portland, which is very rare, the Zoo Bombers and Central Precinct sat down, and I was in that meeting, and they sort of talked about what their issues were with each other, and it was an amazing meeting. In New York, where critical mass has been very contentious, I got a call from one of the attorneys who's working on the issues there, and he said, "What do you guys do in Portland?" And I told him, "Well, we sit down about once a month with some of the critical massers and some of the police," and he really thought I was kidding. He didn't think that that was really what we did, and I had to really say, no, we really, in an effort to try and make it work, you know, sit down to see where the big issues are. And I think, you know, the police bureau and the critical mass participants all deserve a lot of credit for being willing to sit down with someone who they didn't think at the start they were going to get along with or really have much to say to, and working hard through those issues.
And maybe even sitting down with people who had... they had watched those people do some, or at least the people in that profession, do some pretty hurtful things to people they knew or to themselves.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I give people a lot of credit for being willing to sit through that process.
So, some of those meetings started as very heated because of the emotional baggage that both sides brought. And everyone, frankly, were very mature, and they behaved like adults. and they were able to sort of figure out where the real issues lay and figured out where they could even agree to disagree, which I think is a really important thing to be able to do.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think one thing that's important, as you were kind of commenting on getting more people commuting and riding with a friend, is to reconsider the word commuting, because a lot of people who don't ride bikes so much, they see that as that means going to work. And maybe getting, blurring that line to just riding your bike, even if it's just to the video store or to the library with your family, what's safe near your home that you can do. And I think that's something that the Cross Crusades have done very well with the word racing, that people who would never see themselves as a competitive racer are now out there and participating, and that it's really open to everyone, that really it's just people on bikes. It's that's the bigger issue.
That's been the main priority of the Cyclocross Crusade, is to just get the word out about the sport of cyclocross and show people that it's fun. And we actually don't really, believe it or not, people make a living racing cyclocross even right here in the United States. But for the Cross Crusade, we don't really spend a lot of time on those people. The people that we want coming to the Cross Crusade are the, you know, the kind of people that you're talking about.
Exactly.
You know, it's a series. We just do everything we can to make it as fun and easy and non-threatening for people to participate in.
But Brad and the Cross Crusade also deserve a lot of credit in the bike racer community. Your sort of classic winter training bike is you do the cyclocross season, and then as soon as that season's done, you take your cyclocross bike and put fenders on it and ride it through the rest of the rainy season.
Yeah.
On the road, commuting to work, just to ride to the grocery store.
Exactly. That's a cyclocross bike's a great bike, and the bike shops love cyclocross too, because this is a whole new bike they get to sell people, you know. And they, it is a cyclocross bike is a great bike to own too, because you can go kind of basically anywhere you want to go on a cyclocross bike. You can put fenders on it, and away you go.
And a lot of people even tour on cyclocross bikes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you guys so much for being in the studio with us today. We've just recently been talking with Mark Ginsburg. He's a bicycle lawyer and does a lot of great work in the community. And also Brad Ross, the coordinator of the Cross Crusade Cyclocross Race Series. We also talked with other guests earlier in the program. And these are all nominees of the Alice B. Toe Clips Awards, which is an awards ceremony presented by the Bicycle Transportation Alliance to honor people statewide who are doing great work to make this a better bicycling community. Their awards ceremony is this Saturday. I do believe that ticket sales are closed, but it's worth giving the BTA a call just to see if you are interested in attending.
I think they might still be open. I saw something yesterday that
you can find them online at BTA4bikes.org and look them up. We have been having a great show this morning here at our new time, 11 a.m. to noon. You can find us here the first Wednesday of every month. You can also find us podcast online at bikeshow.portlandtransport.com, and you can listen to our program at any time and share it with your friends and family. You can also find some of our programs online through the KBOO website, which is kboo.fm. And we want to give a big thanks to Portland Transport for putting together our podcast for us. The KBOO Bike Show is produced by Sarah Stout, Carl Larson, Tori Bortman, and me, Aileen Crotty. Again, we're on the first Wednesday of every month at our new time from 11 to noon. And if you have ideas for our program, feel free to email us and let us know your ideas. We've got some great shows coming up over the next few months, and we look forward to hearing from you. Our theme song is produced by Wandering Mind Society. You can find them on MySpace at myspace.com/WanderingMindSociety.
Thanks so much for listening, everyone.
Make it a great day and keep riding your bike.
It takes two wheels and no gasoline to keep yourself healthy and to keep the air clean. You can ride in the sunshine, you can ride in the rain. It takes two pedals, two wheels and a chain. Everybody, ride your bicycle. Let's get together and leave our cars home. Everybody, get on your bicycle. Let's get together to pedal and roam. You can take a ride up in Forest Park. You can ride with the light if you ride in the dark. You can ride from the mountains down to the beach. You can ride on the trail, you can ride in the street. You can ride through a puddle, you can ride in the rain. You can take it on a bus, you can take it on a train. Take a ride to the waterfront or down from a zoo. You can take a ride in.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, your community radio station. 91.9 FM in Hood River, 100.7 FM in Corvallis and Albany, and around the world on www.kboo.fm.